Welcome to Art Bell Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from July 19th, 1995.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, and great it is, and a beautiful night, I bid you welcome from Tahiti in the Hawaiian Islands, east to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, north to, we believe, the North Pole, and south down into northern South America. This is Coast to Coast AM. I've calculated, even though the borders have extended, we're in and out of over coasts. So I guess it works. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the program. 5 hours of uninterrupted, live, unscreened talk radio. The most dangerous type and the most fun. We're going to start with something a little bit different this morning. I have on the line, in just a moment, Alan Keyes, presidential candidate, billed as actually it's Ambassador Alan Keyes, former ambassador to the UN, and very much a conservative, a pro-life moral conservative, he calls himself, and we're going to talk to him about his presidential candidacy. In some of the material he sent me, says Alan Keyes electrifies the grassroots, and we've got all kinds of straw poll results here from Salt Lake City, Utah, showing Dole ahead, but Keyes second. Dole at 33, Keyes at 20. Chicago conservatives straw poll, Graham 36, Keyes 35. Clayton County, Georgia, Keyes wins it, 30%, Graham 26, Dole 15. Fresno, California, May 6th, Dole 39, Keyes 31, Wilson, Dornan, Graham trail. April 8th, Oklahoma City, Graham wins, 50%, Keyes number 2, Dole, and Buchanan follow. So a few key straw poll results, if you'll excuse the metaphor, and we're going to talk to Alan Keyes, Ambassador Keyes, right now. So let's do it. Ambassador Keyes, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. You are somewhere in, I guess, Central California?
That's right, Camarillo, I think. I'm staying at the Westlake Hyatt, I guess.
Well, it's nice to have you out here in the West.
Well, thank you.
Ambassador, I would ask you to stay good and close to the phone and give us lots of audio.
Okay.
If you can. I guess I'm going to ask you first, why do you want to be president?
Well, I got into the race mainly out of concern over the assault that was being mounted against, number one, the pro-life plank in the Republican platform, and number two, the strong commitment that the party has had to stand up for what I believe are the key issues in the country affecting the moral and material environment for the marriage-based family. Those issues, which were articulated in a very forthright fashion at the 1992 convention, played an important role in 1994, have been, I think, put on a back burner, or at least there's been an attempt to put them on the back burner by some of the leadership in the party. And so it was in that context that I stood forward and began to articulate in a forthright fashion my concerns about that, and to get a response around the country that encouraged me to believe that there are a lot of people in the Republican Party who believe that these issues need to be addressed, and I think they deserve a voice.
What do you think of Bob Dole's position on his pro-life position? A little shaky?
Well, more than a little shaky, I think, but at the moment entirely unclear. I think both Dole and Graham have been very reluctant to deal with this issue in a forthright way, and even though they point to their record and talk about, well, there I am, I don't have to say any more about it, I think that the key thing that you have to do on the pro-life issue in America is to articulate it. That's what people who are in the national spotlight need to do. That's the way they exert leadership on this issue. So if they're not willing to talk about it, they're not really committed to it.
All right. Well, you're cutting up the pro-life pie right now with Pat Buchanan. How would you define a difference between your position and his on pro-life?
I don't know that there is one. I think we're both strongly committed to keeping the pro-life plank in the Republican platform. I think that that's been important to me. I do think that Pat may have gotten a little shy at first about this issue, because in the first stages of the campaign, he wasn't articulating it. When I stood up, for instance, in Louisiana, I was the only candidate who was putting this forward at the time, and in, I think, Arizona after that, it was still the case. But gradually, I think others came to realize, one, that this issue itself, pro-life, is very important, and I'm glad to see that that has put it back, I guess, in a position of prominence. And others, like Phil Graham and others, are now beginning to recognize that the grassroots people of the Republican Party are insisting that the real moral crisis of this country be put front and center, and that we have to address it or we're not going to be able to deal with most of the other problems that we're facing.
All right, here's one way to address it. The other day I heard, and I can't recall who it was, somebody calling for congressional hearings on when life begins.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a good idea?
Well, I actually think it's not a relevant question. I think that whole debate is based on a misunderstanding of the issue. It is not for us to make that decision. And it really, if you think seriously about the principles that are involved, the Declaration of Independence says that it is an issue of creation. We are created equal, not born equal.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the question is, simply, are we dealing with an offspring that partakes of human nature? And the way in which we determine that is not by looking at what goes on in the womb. You know, dogs come from dogs, cats come from cats, human beings come from human beings. And so you only look at the parentage. You only look at that question of whether the mother and father are human. If the ancestry is human, the offspring is human, and therefore entitled to respect, which is due to the nature of human beings, not because of their development, but simply because of their God-endowed nature.
All right, so in a nutshell, at the moment of creation.
At the moment of creation, and of course that moment precedes any human activity or involvement, and nature is then transmitted by virtue of the lineage of the mother and the father, not by virtue of one stage of development in the womb or anywhere else.
How do you assess, what is your own assessment of the race when you get very pragmatic and you look at it? Alan Keyes, even Pat Buchanan, nearly everybody else but Bob Dole right now seems a long shot. Is that pragmatic?
Not at all. I think this race is wide open. And I don't understand why people are being taken in by early numbers that basically are based on name recognition.
Yes.
And pretty much nothing else. I mean, and if I were Bob Dole right now, I'd be seriously worried. Because his position in the last several months has done nothing but erode. He started out as a front runner in the mid-50s. He's now a front runner tending toward the mid-40s.
Being
that
an early,
doesn't look to me like a tendency that's going to last.
Yeah, being an early front runner traditionally has not been very lucky.
So, you just have lots of time to lose your position.
Yeah, that's right. Nowhere to go but down. What about the Speaker of the House? Now, he's kind of waffling about here and there and suggesting that, well, if there becomes a sudden vacuum in the race, why, he might jump in. What's your take? Do you think he will?
Well, I don't think there is going to be a sudden vacuum in the race.
Well, yeah, but you've got to hope there's going to be one.
Well, no, not at all. I think we're building up a grassroots campaign that isn't going to depend on a vacuum. We are creating a new reality in the Republican Party by consolidating what I think is the pro-life moral majority, if I can put it that way, at the Republican grassroots. We are energizing people, getting new people involved, pulling people out who have been noncommittal in the past, and we're busily organizing over these months and over the course of the next several months to put together what I think will be the strongest grassroots campaign that's been seen in American politics since the late 60s. And that's our objective, and that's what we're working to achieve.
Ambassador, you gave a speech recently on C-SPAN that electrified a lot of people. I had a lot of calls on this program about it. People were very excited. What was the genesis of that speech? What electrified people about that?
Now, do you mean a speech in New Hampshire?
I believe that's the one.
Well, I think that the main thing that caught people was that I was articulating what a lot of people feel, that we have been dealing with our problems in this country for a long time as if we could throw money at them, as if we could spend money on them, as if they were the result of economic factors and money problems. And yet it's increasingly clear that those problems are related to phenomena that have at their root moral rather than material causes, mainly the collapse of the marriage-based family due to, I believe, the adoption of a corrupt concept of freedom that actually contradicts the moral and emotional attitudes that are needed to sustain family life. And so a lot of people have come to the conclusion that we don't have money problems, we have moral problems.
How is
a line in the speech that was very much, I think, on the minds of people who responded to it.
How do you believe the definition of freedom has been corrupted?
Well, you know, freedom is defined in the Declaration of Independence as based on the idea that unalienable rights come from God. And if your rights come from God, then they must be respected out of respect for God's authority. And they must be exercised in a way which also preserves and respects that authority. So the understanding of freedom is naturally tempered with a sense of respect and responsibility toward the authority from which they come. Freedom and responsibility, therefore, go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. In the last 20 or 30 years, we've redefined that. Freedom has been defined in terms of will and choice and convenience and self-gratification with no sense at all that there are any constraints or responsibilities that go along with it. And that is, I think, epitomized in this doctrine of abortion, where freedom is defined in such a way that you need respect, not even the basic principles of freedom itself, and that in the end ends up being self-destructive. And so freedom is defined in such a way that it can be exercised so as to destroy its own premises, and that means that it comes to an end.
Mm-hmm. Let's see how pro-life you are. You know, the big test, of course, is always rape. If a 16-year-old girl is raped, no abortion, Ambassador?
No abortion. The rape incest exceptions have no ground in principle. You cannot punish an innocent human being for the sins of one of its parents. And the notion that you can take the life of an innocent child because the father is guilty of rape is, I think, a travesty of justice.
Mm-hmm. What about the psychological survival of the victim in this case?
Well, I think that you would want to do everything you can, but I think that in the context of that moral universe, you know, the mother also would understand that the innocent life of the child is not to be abused for the sake of the father. And I think that moral balance would, you know, properly counseled, prevent psychological damage from being permanent. There are going to be awful, I think, trauma to go through with rape anyway, whether a child is there or not. And the counseling that is needed to help someone survive the rape would have to take account of the need to prepare them also for the life of the child, including preparing them for the decision to make as to putting the child out to adoption or in other ways that would relieve the lifelong burden of the mother. I don't think that would necessarily be something that the mother would have to be burdened with forever. So you'd want to work with and counsel the mother to get her through this difficult situation. But I think you could do that in a way that would preserve as well the life of the child.
All right. A tougher case, incest.
Same argument holds.
All right.
You cannot punish the child for the sins of its parents.
All right.
It's simply unjust.
One final category, the toughest of all, perhaps, the life of the mother.
Well, see, the life of the mother exception isn't tough at all for me, because in principle, that's the one exception that has to be made. Because according to our doctrine of liberty, we have an unalienable right to life. That word unalienable means that it cannot be surrendered under any circumstances whatsoever. And so we cannot coerce the mother into doing something that, according to our doctrine of freedom, she has no right to do.
How do you delineate
her right to life?
Yes, but how do you delineate? There are two lives as you have defined them.
That's right. So the mother cannot be forced to give up her life. And since she cannot be forced to do it, the state cannot put her in a situation where she is coerced to give up her own life in order to save the life of the child. That does not mean that one could not counsel her as to what the moral choice might be, especially as a parent. You know, I think parents, when we put ourselves in the way of having children, are also putting ourselves in the way of the obligation to risk our lives for their sake. But that is not something I believe that the state can coerce. And so in that situation, you have to make, in this case, an exception where there is a direct threat to the physical life of the mother.
All right. You are very strictly, then, pro-life. I think we've defined that here in the last few moments. Suppose you were to be the Republican candidate running against Bill Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
The polls all show, and the American liberal press constantly repeats them, that about two-thirds of the American people are pro-choice.
That's not true. The only way they reach that figure is by including, as pro-choice, rape, incest, life of the mother exception makers. And they are not pro-choice. They are pro-life.
Okay, but
they are pro-lifers who disagree with me on a couple of points, but they are still in principle pro-life Americans.
Right. Right.
And when you count them as pro-life, over 50% of the American people are pro-life.
All right. But would they not, would that not to, that full two-thirds number be realized when people looked at your very strict definition of pro-life?
So, no, not at all.
No?
I think that within the context of the Republican Party and the pro-life movement, the three exceptioners have worked with the one exception people like myself and the 100%ers for a long time. That is what the pro-life movement is composed of and has been composed of.
All right.
I go to pro-life gatherings all the time where all three varieties of pro-life people are included, and they've worked together for years.
Where do you disagree with Pat Buchanan? I'm not talking now about pro-life. I'm just talking generally. What would be your biggest disagreement with Pat Buchanan?
Well, I think the biggest disagreement, and one that actually exemplifies a fundamentally different approach, is on the immigration issue, where I am strongly in favor of measures like Proposition 187 that limit illegal immigration and seek to enforce the law so as to maintain the distinction between legal and illegal immigration. But I do not accept the notion that immigration overall is to blame for America's problem, and we need a ban on immigration and so forth and so on, which Pat Buchanan has accepted.
Yeah, I think,
I think that's important.
He wants, he says, a time out, a period for assimilation.
Yeah, I think that's important. We cannot shut the door. We can regulate immigration, but immigration is part of the American heritage, and we do not, I believe, have the right to shut our minds to that heritage or our doors to the hope that this nation necessarily arouses in the hearts and minds of people around the world. And it would be unfair. I mean, all of us are but some generations removed from being immigrants of one kind or another ourselves. And I think it's entirely incongruous. It's also just false to blame this country's problems on immigration. You know, if we have a problem, it is a problem with the corruption of our own character, our own standards, our own sense of our moral identity as a people. And that problem wasn't fomented by foreigners. It was fomented by, I don't know, liberal Harvard professors and others who are quite homegrown products, unfortunately.
What about his isolationism? The one area I disagree with Pat Buchanan is his amount of isolationism. And do you share those views generally with him or disagree?
Well, no, I think I am not an isolationist. I believe that America has an important leadership role to play. I believe in our engagement in that leadership in the world for the sake of our interests and our principles. I do believe that in certain areas like the World Trade Organization and so forth, we have engaged in an unconscionable surrender of sovereignty that shouldn't have been tolerated and should not have been supported. But I don't consider that isolationism. I just consider that to be prudent foreign policy, and you don't surrender to a foreign-dominated body control of your border for trade purposes. It doesn't make any sense.
All right. Ambassador, hold on just a moment. We'll be right back to you. Ambassador Keyes, you're back on the air. I want to take you around the world a little bit now, because there's plenty to talk about. We'll start outside the country and with the biggest mess of Bosnia. Yesterday, our Secretary of State, Warren Christopher, seemed to come full circle in a very short time and was back talking about airstrikes. Airstrikes, again, to try and protect what's left of the so-called safe zones. And I'm recalling, gee, didn't we just lose an F-16? And, gee, the last time we had airstrikes, didn't they take U.N. hostages right away? And that stopped it. And the U.N., as far as I know, is still there, huddled in their own little safe areas. And here we have the Secretary of State talking about airstrikes again. It kind of blew my mind. What do you think?
Well, see, I don't understand why it is that we are insisting on taking measures supposedly to defend enclaves and so forth and so on, when we won't take the decisive step of lifting the arms embargo and letting the Bosnian government defend itself.
Dead right.
It doesn't make any sense. This whole UN policy of maintaining a military imbalance that encourages the Serbs to continue the war in the belief that their military advantage will lead to victory. They won't lift the arms embargo. They perpetuate that situation. And then they send in so-called peacekeepers to defend people who could defend themselves by way of not defending them because they can't shoot and they don't do anything. Even it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, it doesn't. Even the liberal Joe Biden was up standing on the floor yesterday, Senate floor, saying genocide, genocide, genocide. It is genocide. And if anything, I almost feel part of it. And
well, see, I think they've been set up, though. In a situation like that, the worst thing that you can do is to leave one side disarmed in the face of the other, so that it cannot defend itself even when it has the will and moral wherewithal, which I think the Bosnians certainly do.
So then how is the president's position morally defended, period?
I don't know, you see, because I think that we ought to have the courage to exert the kind of leadership that we need to in this situation. And if that arms embargo is wrong, we should not be constrained to pursue a wrong-headed policy just because our allies don't have the sense to abandon it. And I think under those circumstances, that's a time when American leadership has sometimes to be exerted on the basis of our ability to act unilaterally. And I think also we need to induce our allies to understand that you shouldn't have peacekeepers in a situation where there is no peace to keep.
That's for sure. But to seemingly return to a policy that was just demonstrated as a failed policy, you know, here within the last couple of months, is incredible. They're absolutely without direction.
Absolutely.
Ambassador, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. Take a rest. Drink a cup of coffee or something. We'll be right back to you.
Okay.
Ambassador Alan Keyes, candidate for president, back in a moment.
Bell, Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from July 19, 1995.
My guest is presidential candidate Ambassador Alan Keyes. We'll get back to him in just a moment. Let me take care of a little bit of business here right at the beginning, and then it'll be clear sailing to the top of the hour. We've only got him for an hour, so we've got to make max use of the time. Back now to Ambassador Alan Keyes. Ambassador, welcome back.
Hi.
Yesterday, the president gave his long-awaited, anticipated speech on affirmative action. The bottom line seems to be that he would like to keep it. He talks about no quotas, no preferences for individuals, unqualified individuals, no reverse discrimination, but said the president, quote, we should make a simple slogan, mend it, but don't end it. And so there you are, Bob Dole, Phil Graham, everybody out criticizing the president's position. Here's your chance. Do you agree or disagree?
Well, I think the president's position is basically a lot of double talk. It represents no change in the existing situation. The thing that I've noticed about the proponents of quotas and all of that is that now that they've realized that the overwhelming majority of the American people are against those things, they're turning around and saying, oh, quotas? We never were favoring anything like that. Far be it from us to have ever suggested anything like that. It's all doublespeak. And what essentially Clinton's speech was today was the same thing. How, may I ask, are you going to have a situation of preferences when you don't have reverse discrimination?
I don't know. How do you have affirmative action without quotas, really? I don't understand that either.
Okay, the notion, if you were to return to the original notion that you were going to have, outreach, if you were going to make sure that certain portions and areas of the country and disadvantaged groups of people were given, you know, information, access, that you made sure your recruiters for companies would visit high schools that were in these areas, make sure kids were apprised of opportunities, help to create programs that would give people who were disadvantaged special training and so forth and so on. That kind of action, I don't think anybody in the country objects to, especially if you're targeting disadvantage to bring people up to a, you know, even place at the starting line. That is different than establishing quotas and preferences that are based on gender, based on sort of biological factors and racial factors. I think most Americans see that as simply unfair. It's a return to the principle that you're going to be judged by your lineage, your heritage, your background, and so forth and so on, instead of being judged on the basis of your individual merit. And I think that that contradicts a long-standing American tradition that goes all the way back to the beginning of the colonies in this country, where people came here to escape that kind of system of ancestral privilege in the old world. It is just a wrong principle, and I think it contradicts the basic American sense of fairness.
Mm-hmm. Congressman Mifumi, who heads the Black Caucus yesterday, said, quote, Senator Dole, Senator Graham, Governor Wilson, Mr. Buchanan, we challenge you and others as yet unmentioned, that would be you, I guess, to once again present improved alternatives to fight discrimination. In other words, you're going to do away with affirmative action. How do you continue to fight discrimination?
Well, as I just said, I think if you are worried about the disadvantages that have resulted from past patterns of discrimination, the usual argument made for affirmative action,
that's correct,
then target those disadvantages. Go to those areas where you have low-income people, where you have poor educational system, where you have, you know, people who have been, you know, deprived maybe in terms of educational opportunities in the past, and target those disadvantages. But the mere fact that my children, for instance, are black children, should not mean that in spite of their, you know, favorable economic circumstances, they get special privileges in this society and special consideration. It is wrong.
Well, you use the word target. Target how? I mean, how do you target the disadvantage without providing advantage?
But what I'm saying is, when I say target the disadvantage, the notion that you provide help for people, say scholarship help to people who are from low-income families, I don't think people object to this. And yet that's a form of affirmative action for low-income people, isn't it?
It is.
But it's not something people object to because it's not based on a racial classification or gender. If you're somebody who is in need and has the ability, we'll help you out. And I think that the same is true in terms of job training and other things of that sort. It could be true even in terms of job recruitment, to make sure that in the pool of applicants who you are considering for a job, you have people of diverse backgrounds. But I think what people would object to is the notion that once you get into the pool for consideration, you are going to be given a job based on your skin color instead of based on your qualifications.
Yeah, well,
I think all of those things, right up to the point where you make that judgment, are things that people would accept. But once you're at the starting line, they want you to be judged on a fair basis based on your individual merit and qualification.
Well, I guess we have come a long way. The obvious question I should ask now as a follow-up, since we're in this category, is can a black man be elected president in America today?
Well, sure. I think that a person can be elected president in America if what they are offering to the people of the country correspond to what is on the hearts and minds of a majority of the voters at the time they stand for office as the key challenges, the key agenda for policy facing the country. I think that that's going to be the determining factor in 1996.
All right. There are two big hearings going on right now, Waco and the Whitewater hearings, looking into the death of Vince Foster. If you want to give me your take on either one, that's fine. But my question is instead sort of political.
Hmm.
Let's, for a second, imagine that something turns up in Whitewater that creates a bigger vacuum than anybody expected. In other words, it gets the president. Would you rather run against President Clinton or whoever else the Democrats might come up with?
Hmm. Well, you know, I think that most Republicans would certainly prefer that you have a malingering Bill Clinton,
mm-hmm.
who is suffering from what appears to be a low-grade but reasonably fatal political fever.
Well, gee, that's going to give him a tough choice. Suppose they come up with something that would, in effect, take him out.
Well, but that's the point I'm making. If you take Clinton out, there would be the possibility, I think, that the Democrats would actually turn to somebody electable
exactly.
who would give the Republicans a run. It would not necessarily decide the outcome, of course, because I think that as shown in 1994, the American people, I think, are very deeply suspicious of the agenda that Democrats have to offer and of the dominance in the Democratic Party of a liberal Reed socialist wing that really prefers government-dominated solutions and high taxes and high government spending. I think any Democrat is going to have to run with that wing of the party hanging around their neck. Which I think is basically one that does not correspond to the values and preferences of the American people. So the Republicans would still have their best shot in a long time at controlling both the White House and the Congress. But it might be a little tougher than if you're running against the weakest vote.
You've probably got better information than I do, and you can jump away from this one if you want. But is there anything in your opinion contained in what will come out in Whitewater or in the Waco hearings that would disable the president?
Well, I don't know that I have any better information than you do. I kind of doubt it. But I would say that my impression is that nothing that comes out in the Waco hearings is going to damage the president. I think what comes out in the Waco hearings ought to seriously damage Janet Reno, but then what has already come out should have resulted in her resignation. I think in terms of Whitewater, my guess is that the direct Whitewater things are not going to.
All right, Ambassador, before we get too much into Whitewater, I recall that after Waco, and you'll, of course, recall, Janet Reno said, we're doing this, we're going to do this for the children.
Mm.
And then it was done. The children that did survive were then later interviewed by psychiatrists who said they were not abused.
Mm.
And yet yesterday in the Waco hearings, here came a now 14-year-old who claimed Koresh had sex with her when she was 10.
Mm.
Now, I presume you saw or heard about that testimony.
I certainly did. I didn't see the testimony. I heard about it. My wife watched it, and I talked to her just earlier this evening when I was out doing my campaigning thing. And I have to say that we're looking at an effort, I believe, to distract the attention of the public from the real issue. Because the question of whether David Koresh was, did at some point abuse children,
mm-hmm.
does not then solve the question of whether Janet Reno made a correct judgment when they stormed that compound and in a way that they, I think, could have been reasonably certain was going to result in the destruction of life.
Mm-hmm.
Did they have a proper foundation and basis for taking that step?
All right,
I think all the evidence that has come out so far suggests that they did not.
Secretary of the Treasury Rubin was on one of the Sunday shows here a couple of weeks ago, and they asked him repeatedly whether the president authorized the final assault on the compound at Waco, and he refused in each time to answer that question. Is that a question that should be answered in the hearings?
Yes, it is. I think it's a question that should be answered because we need to determine, one, just where the responsibility lies. Of course, the responsibility, in a sense, I believe, always lies with the president, when it's his administration. But I think that the actual line of decision needs to be clear, and also the extent of Bill Clinton's incompetence needs to be made clear. Because I think if he was involved and did authorize the final assault, then he bears the ultimate responsibility for that disaster. If he was not involved, then I think that's a clear indication of incompetence, since he should have been. That was, after all, a situation in which you had the lives of 85 Americans, including children, at stake, where the government was heavily involved. And if Bill Clinton was not keeping himself abreast of it and informed, and if he had not left instruction that before any final decision was made he was to be involved, then he's an incompetent who certainly ought to be removed from office in the next election.
Again, the Secretary of the Treasury and others have expressed pre-worry about the hearings that what will come out of it will damage gun control efforts. Now, I found those statements odd, as if they know something we don't. If David Koresh is simply portrayed as a crazy child molester, or whatever it is they're going to portray him as, in what way would that damage gun control efforts? There must be something that they imagine that's going to come up that's going to make the government look like the jackbooted thugs that somebody called them some time ago.
Well, I think there is a lot of fear about that because there have been a lot of questions raised about whether or not their approach to that question was one justified and two carried out in a competent way that respected the rights of the people who were involved. I think those are questions about the overall attitude toward gun control and gun regulation and how it's being enforced that are on the minds of a lot of law-abiding citizens in this country.
Yes, indeed they are. And what is your position?
Well, I'm a strong supporter of the Second Amendment, and I believe that the whole gun control agenda is actually based on a false premise. The notion that human beings are not responsible for their acts, but instead their instruments are. And I think that that's an absurd denial of human moral capacity and accountability. So I think that both in principle and in fact, because empirically gun control also doesn't have any impact on crime. It's a phony solution for a real problem.
Okay, then what is the motivation for those pushing for it?
Well, I think it's twofold. I think you have people who are just opposed to gun ownership and would like to see people in this country disarmed and wish the Second Amendment out of the Constitution. I think you have others who are deluded into believing that you can take the totemic approach to crime control, set the gun up as a totem, and if you only remove it, that's going to deal with the problem. Of course, you're removing it from the wrong hand, and it does not have an impact on the real problem. I think there are also others who are simply, you know, I believe, subscribing to an agenda that's been around for a long time, in which you want to produce a society in which the citizens are not armed, the government is the only armed party, which then makes it a society easier to control and easier to subjugate.
You're describing the fear, the main fear, I think, of the militias. I've always rather thought the gun controllers are doing it because they're powerless to do anything else, and the gun is basically defenseless politically and an easy target. So,
well, see, that's what I mean by the totemic approach.
Sure.
Because I think it's basically setting the gun up as a totem, and then by getting rid of the totem, you're getting rid of the problem. It's an excuse for looking like you're doing something, even though it has nothing to do with the real issue.
Your take on the militias and the investigations?
Well, you know, I think that's partly a phony issue. If there are people who are involved in real law-breaking and real crime, then investigate those crimes and deal with the law-breaking. The mere fact that people are part of the militias and are exercising their Second Amendment rights, if they do so within the law, is not an issue at all. And I don't think that it should be raised as one. I think the militias are being demonized as part of the campaign to demonize gun ownership overall.
The anti-terrorism legislation that's pending, I recall seeing a militia fellow stand and look a senator in the eye and say, if you pass this, it's not a matter of when, or rather if, but only a matter of when, referring to an armed conflict.
Well, you know, I think that the counterterrorism legislation does have in it a lot of off-the-shelf elements that aren't related to really dealing with the problem of terrorism, in which they are giving powers to the president to determine what terrorist groups are in very broad language that I think could be dangerous not just to militias, but to anybody who happens to have a political opinion that's adverse to the government in power at the time. And I think that those kinds of steps are not necessary. The notion that we have to give up our liberties in order to have security in this society returns us, I think, to the false reasoning that has led human beings to be subjugated by despotic governments for centuries before this country was founded. This country is based on the notion that liberty and order can go hand in hand. That requires, of course, that you have a self-disciplined citizenry and a government that respects the rights of that citizenry.
Sounds
and that's
like
what we ought to be working towards.
Sounds like there's a lot of libertarianism in Alan Keyes. Is that true?
Well, I think at one level there is. I mean, there are limits to that libertarianism because I think in the end, yes, government exists to secure our rights, but our sense of what our rights are has to be grounded in a firm sense of the difference between right and wrong.
What would President, what would President Alan Keyes, for example, then, do with regard to the drug war? Almost everybody agrees what we're doing right now is not working. Now, there's been a call for a national referendum on drugs. Legalize them or get really tough. What do you think?
Well, see, I don't think you can legalize drugs at this stage of the game because to legalize would be a grant of permission, which I think would just add an element that completed the moral destruction of this society, which is already moving along at a fast enough pace as it is, I believe. So I think that you have to get serious about enforcement, but you also have to get serious about the moral education that arms people against drug use. I think that's the real source of the drug problem in America. It's an aspect of the moral collapse of the country. Because in point of fact, if you have a citizenry that has a decent respect for itself, drug abuse would not be a serious problem because people would realize that it is incompatible and inconsistent with the rational exercise of their freedom. But we don't have that sense of a strong moral identity because it's no longer being inculcated in our children, no longer being passed along with a sense of standards and self-discipline. So I think that you have to have tough law enforcement, you have to have a moral restoration that then is based, I believe, on the Nancy Reagan approach, that you don't teach kids about the moral calculus of drug use. You teach them that it is morally wrong and that you don't do things that are morally wrong.
Mm-hmm. What would that mean in terms of, for example, where you would want to see money put in fighting drugs? Would you want to interdict? Would you want to treat? Would you want to do all of it? how would you come down there?
Well, you see, I think that on the one hand, you do have to have a serious effort to reduce the flow, always keeping in mind that you'll never reduce it to nothing. And one of the things I learned when I was on the White House Conference for Drug-Free America, chairing the International Committee, we got lots of information, lots of testimony, all of which suggested two things. One, you can have an effective interdiction program that cuts the flow of drugs, but you can't cut it off. And two, the reason you can't cut it off is that demand creates its own supply. And you always have somebody to supply the drugs, and they'll find some way to get them in so long as you have demand. So you have to look at the demand side, and that, I think, has to be based on education. Not education, by the way, based on this notion of, you know, teaching people the danger of drugs and all of this. That has to be an element of it. But the key element needs to be, I think, the moral rearmament, particularly of our young people.
How about enforcement? The majority of our inmates in jail are in there on at least drug-related, you know, problems. Do you continue to arrest users? Do you go after the sellers? What?
I think you have to do both, with a particular emphasis on going after the sellers and those who are profiteering from drug abuse, but you also can't let the users off the hook. I think a more effective way than maybe imprisonment and so forth for users would be to stigmatize and remove certain privileges. That would include things like driving and other things like that, so that you are disabling those who are disabling the society through drug abuse.
All right. This is sort of the vision thing. I call it the quickening. I've been doing talk shows now for this one for over a decade. Events are accelerating. Political, economic, in every sector of society, they're accelerating, and I've been calling it the quickening. You're calling it a moral degeneration. You think they are the same things? Are they related?
Well, yes and no. I think we can be too impressed with how times have changed. I guess I believe that the more things change, the more they remain the same. That in point of fact, we don't face a problem today that hasn't been with human beings since time immemorial.
All right,
we are a society that has built wonderful computers, and yet we act as if we can't keep our children out of bed with each other. Yet this was a skill that even the most primitive society mastered several thousand years ago.
Ambassador, time may be immemorial, but I'm out of it. I'm out of it. We're out of it, and you have to get up early in the morning. Let's do it again, all right?
Yes, indeed. I enjoyed it.
Ambassador Keys, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from July 19th, 1995. Presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired July 19th, 1995.
Last hour, we interviewed Ambassador and presidential candidate Alan Keyes. And that took up the entire hour, and that wasn't enough time. I could have covered about 100 miles more territory with a man. Certainly an interesting individual. Hanging in, I would say, the second part of the pack, if you will, despite some polling information, sort of in a category with, I think, Pat Buchanan. And I don't know even how to assess the race anymore. There's a different straw polls, different polling information tells us all kinds of things. Dole is up, Dole is down, Keyes is up, Keyes is down. Buchanan is hot and catching fire or not. I don't know that I know, and I guess there's just, we'll have to wait. We are again adding affiliates to the network, going to the 192 mark. There's going to be a big celebration when we hit 200. Coming shortly, WAZL in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, and KIOV in Payette, Indiana, another station in Indiana. So those two stations on the way. 192. So we're, you know, I don't. It's hard to say because it goes in big spurts, sort of. But it's possible, I suppose, that we're going to hit 200 within the month, and we will use that as a mark to celebrate. There's no doubt about it. That's awfully big. I don't know how it got so big. I want to update you on the Roswell situation before we get into the news. And there is some updating to do. Boy, there's a couple of interesting things. The Roswell film, the stills of what, from that film, I've got a couple of comments, and then I've got some information from Congressman Schiff on this particular set of 16-millimeter films. Hi again, Art. Why did Congress really decide, that's one I want to hold. Here we go. I recently downloaded all five pictures of the alien bodies supposedly obtained from Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. And I've got to tell you, my first impression of the pictures really disturbed me. They seemed so real. They do seem so real. If the pictures are not authentic, then I think this is one of the best alien special effect models I've ever seen. But it appears the story of the film and pictures is beginning to get the attention of the network news services. I was watching KNXV, an ABC affiliate, Phoenix, Arizona, tonight, around 10:15 Phoenix time, when a segment of the news mentioned a congressman from New Mexico requesting the Air Force release films of the dissection of an alien body found in the wreckage of a crashed UFO in 1947. Supposedly, the Air Force reply was the films of the dissection were, quote, just an experiment gone wrong, end quote. I couldn't believe what I heard. Is the Air Force acknowledging something here? Maybe some listeners could confirm what I heard tonight. Wow. Next item. This is a newspaper article, I presume, from New Mexico. I think probably from New Mexico. Written by Leslie Linthium, I believe it is. Journal staff writer. It is either the scoop of the century or a very gruesome hoax. After watching a grainy 15-minute film purporting to show the autopsy of a space alien captured in the Roswell incident in 1947, U.S. Representative Stephen Schiff is unsure. The New Mexico Republican is not exactly endorsing the footage, reportedly taken by a U.S. Army photographer on the Roswell Army airfield in 1947, but on the other hand, he's also not dismissing it as bunk either. He said, quote, there's one thing for sure. If this is a hoax, it certainly was elaborately done. It looked real to me, end quote. If the footage is verifiable, it would be the first hard evidence that it was a UFO, not an Air Force experiment gone awry, as the government contends. And there's a lot more to the article, but the bottom line, obviously, to it is that Congressman Schiff is very interested in the film. Now, as you know, we interviewed Ray Santilli, the man who is in possession of that film, and in fact, then the next night, repeated that interview. That was last night. Now the night before. God, the days just run together. And I thought that he was, Mr. Santilli, that is, was very credible. Not because he's in the UFO community, and maybe because of that, but because he just ran into the film. He just ran into the film, and he's dealing with it the way he does everything. That's his business, you know, he's in the business. And so somehow his falling into it when he was in search of early film from Presley's career, I don't know, it just sort of makes sense. His attitude about it sort of makes sense to me. Now, I'm going to repeat this only once, maybe once more during the morning. There are two ways for you to see these photographs. The first way is if you own a computer and you know how to download, you can call our bulletin board, which is available 24 hours a day. There are five photographs entitled Roswell 1.GIF through 5, and you can see them that way. Or they are now in the hands of our publishers of the newsletter. That's right, they've already got the photographs, and they're being set up, and they're going to be printed in our newsletter. Our newsletter is, many of you already get it, so you've got it made, is $29.95 for a full year. A full year. Comes to you every month without fail. It is getting to be a significant newsletter. We cover things on this program, things that we do on Dreamland. The whole spectrum is in the newsletter. Lots of photographs. We've gone to color. You're going to love it. Anyway, the Roswell photographs, by special permission from Ray Santilli, are going to be published in the next newsletter, and it's a going to press. So if you order now, you will get that one. I'm telling you. Jump on the newsletter now. If you don't have a computer, if you can't get them that way, then get them this way. Back in a moment with the rest of the news. Well, all right. We touched on it with Ambassador and Presidential Candidate Alan Keyes. Affirmative action. The President finally had his words to say on affirmative action. And while he says no quotas, no preferences for unqualified individuals, and no reverse discrimination, at the same time, he seems to want to have it both ways. He said, quote, we should have a simple slogan, mend it, but don't end it, end quote. And a lot of us, and I agree with the ambassador here, don't understand how you keep it without having quotas, preferences, because that's the core of affirmative action. Anything you do, even a scholarship, which I do not object to, is in a sense, when given to a minority because of a perceived discrimination that has occurred, is a sort of a preference, isn't it? So the question is, what do we do? And Congressman Mifumi, who heads the Black Caucus, asked Senator Dole, Senator Graham, Governor Wilson, Mr. Buchanan, we challenge you and others as yet unnamed, thinking no doubt there'll be more candidates, to once again present improved alternatives, or I guess any alternatives, to fight discrimination. If not affirmative action, then what? Now, here's a fax on the subject from Ivan in Lincoln, Nebraska, who writes, Art, I heard the President today during his speech on affirmative action make a comment concerning the BATF officers present at the good old boys' picnic. The comment was something to the effect that if there are any racists in government law enforcement, they should find work elsewhere. So let's see if I've got it right here. If you're a citizen and have white supremacist views or racist views, the government will come to your house and kill your wife and shoot your kid after killing your dog. But if you're in the government, you should find work elsewhere. Sounds awfully unfair to me. That's Ivan in Lincoln. Bosnia could not be worse, but it is by the day. The Serbs are rolling over everything in sight, the last being the so-called safe area. They've got to think up a new name for these areas. They're not really exactly safe areas, are they? They are numbered targets, and the last is Zepa, the second so-called safe haven to fall within the last 2 weeks, without, I might add, even a little bit of resistance from the UN. Bosnia, as NBC observed, is in free fall. Tens of thousands of more refugees are now on the move. Officials now admit they have no way to defend an even larger Muslim enclave, Grajda. The flying in of European troops, this was an idea proffered by the French, I think, a couple of days ago, is now out. They say too dangerous. Helicopters coming in, too dangerous, sorry. The latest idea, yesterday's idea, well, the day before, as you know, they talked about renewed airstrikes. They upped an ante yesterday and said, well, maybe what we'll do is threaten massive airstrikes if Grajda is attacked. It's tragic, and probably I shouldn't laugh, and I'm laughing not at the tragedy, which is awful. I'm laughing at the absolutely ridiculous, almost Keystone Cop-like response of the Clinton administration to this whole thing. Obviously arm the Muslims, but even it's getting late for that. I mean, it's almost over. Get the UN the hell out of there and then get out of the UN. That's what I would like to see happen. Susan Smith trial, Union, South Carolina, a bombshell piece of testimony yesterday. The ex-boyfriend of Susan Smith was on the stand telling about their troubled love affair, and he said, this is Tom Finley, I think he's a 28-year-old, said on the day of the murders, Susan Smith came to him and told him that she'd been having a sexual relationship with his father. Then, later, and as a matter of fact, he thought at that point she was suicidal. Then later, she came back and told him no, she made up that story. A week before the murders, he had written her a letter in which he had said in part, quote, they're saying to Susan, there are some things about you that aren't suited for me. I don't want to be responsible for anyone else's children, end quote. Now, if she is convicted, she, with a unanimous vote, faces the death penalty. And I've got the same question for you today I had yesterday. Susan Smith, I think that anybody who would drown their own two children or kill their own children is arguably, either at the time of the crime or still, crazy as a loon. It was horrible. What happened was horrible. But you would have to be crazy to do that. I mean, you just have to be. And so do we in this country, should we in this country, execute crazy people? You think she was crazy when she committed those crimes? Well, I think a lot of you are going to say yes. And so then the next question is, should we execute crazy people in this country? The O.J. trial. Now, there's some pretty interesting testimony occurring in the O.J. trial. And yesterday, the tow truck driver, you know, the guy who took the Bronco to the impound yard, had first said, actually, the day before, he didn't see any blood. But then he got on the stand yesterday and said, well, you know, I wasn't wearing my glasses. And so, you know, I didn't see very well. And you got to wonder, why is a tow truck driver out there without glasses? So it sort of took away from that testimony. And I was wondering, and still really am, why the defense has bothered to put on a case at all. There was some interesting testimony from a cameraman who has helped O.J. by claiming or by adding to the claim that authorities framed him for the murder of his ex-wife and, of course, Ron Goldman. Willie Ford said that he saw no bloody socks when he filmed Simpson's bedroom room, and none could be seen in the videotape screened in court. Now that, ladies and gentlemen, is absolutely significant. Absolutely significant. Art have seen the alien photos and caught the interview with a gentleman who has the rights to the film. Interesting that all the creatures were female. Maybe they heard we had freshly cut flowers here on Earth, huh? But that was 47, which brings me to this. After 48 years, are we any more prepared to meet our extraterrestrial neighbors or treat their remains with some respect? That's an interesting question. There is more news, but I guess I better get started on the phone lines. God, Waco, I need to comment on Waco. We'll get it in. Let me open the phone lines. There's more, actually more than Waco. It's getting to the point where the amount of research I do, maybe I need to cut down. It seems like I come in, you know, prepared to do about two shows. Wildcard line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi. I got through. This is Midiana from Portland.
Portland.
Hi. I hope you got my condolence card on Ghost. I was walking through my bookstore and I saw this beautiful Arizona landscape, and I thought Art has to have this, so I trust you and your wife enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Also, I in one of my letters, I suggested you go see Braveheart, and I hope you did.
Oh, I have a copy of it, dear.
Oh, great. Terrific. Odds and ends tonight. I won't talk about Bosnia because it's just too hard, but on the guest that you interviewed earlier in your program,
yes, the Ambassador Keyes.
Right. On the drug question, he was absolutely right in terms of you need to deal with demand, because supply is always going to find a way. So if you don't deal with demand, it doesn't matter how many fields in Colombia you bomb, because it will always come up.
Yeah, that probably still should not stop you from pursuing both avenues.
Well, that's true, you know, but, you know, if you deal with demand, then supply will dry up economically. Newsweek did have a story about gangs in the military. It's true.
Oh, yeah, I know. I read it.
And it was really weird. I'm looking for, if I dialed everything correctly, I signed it through your newsletter. I'm looking forward to the Roswell photos.
Oh, they're unbelievable.
And someone called in the other night and said, you know, there was some flack about why were they all female. Well, even our own Air Force, I realize this is Earth, but they did studies on, you know, women would be better pilots because of coordination or something. So
why would we even assume that their sexual organs, whatever they might have or might not have, in fact, how do we even know they have them?
Right, really. Well, someone called in and said, you know, that's...
You know, our female, thank you, female is our perception, right? We define that by the differences between men and women, human beings, right? But who's to say that a creature from anywhere else would be sexually defined in the same manner we are? That's very presumptuous. Yeah, one more time. You hear me on this. We're publishing the Roswell photos in our newsletter. You still have time to order our newsletter. We're doing stuff like this all the time, and I will continue to do it because you know I pursue things of this sort. So if you want the newsletter, if you want the photographs in this next newsletter, you need to get on the stick now. I'll be giving you the deadline. I got the photos to the publisher yesterday. The number to order, it's our newsletter is Art Bell After Dark, it's called. All right, I see I'm at the bottom of the hour. I'm out of time. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from July 19th, 1995. We'll be right back. Steve Dwart Bell, Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from July 19, 1995.
All right, the following is from Timbo in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. Listening to WTDY. Art, good morning. Are you planning on having your bulletin board system hooked up to the internet like Telenet? The answer is yes. To go on, he says, I must say you are becoming very popular on the internet. For your listeners who use computers, I suggest visiting the IRC channel, /art-bell. The dash in the middle, I guess. That's /art-bell. It's full of listeners right now from coast to coast and beyond. It's a sort of virtual reality feedback session about your show. Keep up the good work. OJ Guilty, Go Marsha Go. Susan Smith, Guilty. Execute, says Timbo up in Sun Prairie. West of the Rockies, you're on the air first. Hi.
Hi, this is The Economist in Monterey.
Uh-huh.
How are you doing?
I'm doing.
Well, I heard about your little affirmative action problem there, and I got a solution for you.
My problem?
Yeah, instead of throwing it out, why not mend it?
That's the president's statement.
Right, and I'm here to give you how to mend it.
How do you mend it?
Okay, so you have a quota for a government contract on a bid,
yeah.
And you pass by the first company, and it's the lowest bid, but it's the best price, and it's owned by a white person.
Mm.
Then you got the second bid, which the government accepts, and it's owned by a minority company.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the problem. You don't want to result in all this inefficiency, so you make the company who won the bid, the second lowest bidding price, reimburse the first company or compensate them for the amount that they would have had to spend extra. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Where did you study economy?
No, I'm just saying this in purely compensatory grounds.
Yeah, I understand, but I mean, it seems so ridiculously complicated and socialist to me that I just can't figure out where you got such a thing.
No, if one person is made worse off due to a policy goal that requires a racial equality, then that person...
God sakes, we're going to end up compensating everybody for everything. Now, that's ridiculous.
Right. In other words, why would you have a quota system unless you're going to compensate those who you're taking away
then,
from?
To a lesser degree, everybody else who lost the bidding of all sorts of stripes and sexuality... they deserve some sort of compensation.
But they couldn't bring the job in under the price, which results in efficiency. You don't want to sacrifice efficiency for racial equality, do you? And if you do, then you want to compensate those and make up for that loss of efficiency.
All right, well, send that in a letter to the president. Actually, it sounds to me like something he'd like. You know, I'm sure that'd sound good to him. Briefly, oh God, that was incredible. On Waco, there was a lot of sound and fury and some substance yesterday in the hearings. I must say that I have been affected by what I heard yesterday. Now, you'll recall, and I've said a million times, that the children that came out of Waco alive, who were examined by psychiatrists and the whole battery of people they had look at them, said that, no, they were not molested, they were not mistreated. But yesterday came a 14-year-old girl testifying that at 10, she was indeed sexually molested by David Koresh. Does this justify the raid and the manner of the raid and all the rest of it on the compound? No. Does it give me pause for thought with regard to the way I've thought of Koresh? Yes, it does. A 10-year-old girl. 10-year-old girl. What kind of religion demands a 10-year-old girl giving up her virginity to the leader? Wasn't he always reading from the Bible? Which Bible was that? First time caller line, you're on the air. Good morning.
My mom said that she's sorry about your ghost. And it made her cry.
Made me cry too, dear.
Yeah, and also...
As a matter of fact, at the top of the hour here, I've got something to say about it.
I haven't said anything about it in a while, but I've got something to say. It was very sad, but I'll tell you this. From terrible, even tragic things can come good things, and what the audience has done is a good thing, and we'll talk a little bit about that.
And also, she was wondering, how is Shadow?
How is Shadow? Shadow, all right, listen on the air. Where are you, by the way?
Sacramento.
Well, how old are you?
13.
You tell your mom I said hi, and I'll tell both of you now about Shadow. I have never, you know how I picked Shadow? I went down on this tragic day when Ghost left. And for about an hour after the decision, terrible decision, I really didn't know what to think or do. And so I said, I'm going to go adopt a cat. And I went down to the animal shelter, and we looked at, I guess, hundreds of cats. Oh, man, there were cats everywhere. And I went through them all, and there were many, many pitiful, beautiful, cute little cats, and we got to the final, I wanted to see every single one of them. We got to the final little shelter area packed full of cats. And here comes this little black imp of a sort of a waif of a cat, which immediately climbed up me. You know how cats do that. And nuzzled my neck and started licking my ear and climbed right up on my shoulder. Never seen anything like it. Now, that hasn't changed. This is a cat that has an unnatural love of human beings. I have never seen anything like it. She is such a love bug that it's driving my other cat totally to distraction. And I've got a 17-pound cat, right? Big'un. Really a big'un. And this little gal, I don't think she could be more than like 2-3 pounds maybe at the most. She pushes my 17-pound cat around like he's so much like a dust bunny on the floor, you know? I mean, she just moves him around the house where she wants him. He's scared of her. I don't get it. So they're going through cat adjustment right now, but in answer to your question about Shadow, she's a human being lover. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, is she a lover. There was a story that ran that I've got to get out because it's too incredible. It was entitled Money Shot, and NBC ran it, and it's short and sweet. 10 years ago, there was a lady golfer who was injured when, listen carefully, her own golf ball ricocheted off some train tracks and hit her in the face. Did her damage. Her own golf ball. So she turned around and sued the country club and won a $40,000 judgment. That was a decade ago. Yesterday, in Maine, the Maine Supreme Court upheld the judgment. Now, of course, there's probably more to the story somehow, something there has to be that we haven't heard. But you fire a shot, it ricochets, comes back and hits you in the face, and you get to successfully sue the country club where it occurred. That's crazy. Now, there's got to be something, obviously, that I don't know about this case, because it's crazy. How can that be? East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. This is Jerry from Minneapolis.
Hi.
Hey, I wanted to comment on those Waco hearings.
Yes.
No surprise there, I suppose. But I thought it was very inappropriate to have this poor little girl testify today. I did not think that was germane to what this hearing should be finding about, since there was no jurisdiction on the part of the federal government to pursue any of this line of questioning.
I think, nevertheless, though, Jerry, it had impact. It did on me.
Oh, it had great impact. It was a great political game scored by the Democrats and showed the Republicans were not prepared to follow the line of questioning about Mr. Jewell, the father of this poor girl,
mm-hmm.
who was in a severe custody battle with his wife and is associated with the Cult Awareness Network, which mm-hmm. is famous for their brainwashing techniques.
Yes, yes. And a lot of people suggest that Cult Awareness is the one that kind of got a BATF going on all this in the first place.
But, exactly
but,
right.
But still, Jerry, it has modified my view of Koresh, because my previous view of Koresh definitely was colored by the questioning of the children who survived. And I thought, no, this guy has not been molesting children, but he was.
Well, I have never thought highly of Koresh at any time. It still does not justify an assault on what on the compound, and I
no, it doesn't.
And I do question total validity of her comments. That poor girl today, she may be being manipulated right now, and a lot of those graphic terms she was using, I think, were used to score political points more than anything else.
Well, of course, everything, Jerry, is political.
Well, I have less doubts about how this thing is going to go along based on kind of what happened today, the fireworks today. It's so highly charged, and to bring this poor girl out as your prima facie number one witness was, I think, really a pathetic ploy, and it showed the Republicans were not ready to deal with it because they wouldn't touch her with a 10-foot pole.
Well, and I understand that. Thank you very much, Jerry. Of course they couldn't, and I think he's right. I think they were indeed not prepared for it at all. In Los Angeles yesterday, actually there were two separate shooting incidents. One of them involved a gunman with a semi-automatic weapon. He decided he was working for the city of L.A. He walked into the municipal building and started shooting the people he worked with. He shot four of them dead. Police have got him. He's under arrest tonight. All of the people worked for the city. Now, this was almost an also told in the news. It's getting to the point, that used to be a big story. You know, people would be shot, somebody would go on a rampage, and there would be big gun control stories, there would be big arguments about gun control and all the rest of it. Now, it's just another shooting rampage story, you know, and it's kind of getting buried in the back of the news. I wonder if we're going to get to the point in America where, oh, somebody went on a rampage and killed a bunch of postal employees. It's just not news anymore. Maybe we're going to get to that point. Isn't that awful? Wildcard Line, you're on the air.
Hi, Art.
Hello.
This is Dr. Bob. I want to talk a little bit about alien life.
All right.
One of the things I do is molecular astrophysics.
Okay. So you say.
I do this.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting characteristics that we found in molecular clouds, we've actually found amino acids.
The building blocks of life.
That's right. Also, amino acids are very prevalent in the solar system. Well, people were concerned about the sex of aliens. It turns out that competitively, the having sexes is a favorable ecological, or well, it's a favorable for the species to evolve. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Oh yes. Mm-hmm.
So if the Roswell aliens did have a sex, it would not be surprising. It turns out that from what has been pieced together in the actual scientific journals and things about extraterrestrial life, is that there will be characteristics, and it will be probably carbon-based. And the reason for that is that carbon is produced in the supernova of stars.
Is that right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So there's carbon is more abundant than any of the other elements, possibly like silicon. As was reported in a Scientific American article probably two decades ago.
Okay. I have one question for you, and maybe you could try and answer it for me. I hear you go on other talk shows and take big-time shots at me for talking about subjects like this you don't make those criticisms to my face or my ear directly.
No,
you know, face. Wait a minute, face to face. And yet, you come on my program, and that is your chosen topic. I, sir, think that is highly hypocritical.
Can I respond?
Yes. Now, go right ahead.
Okay, I'll respond this way because I think a lot of the evidence that you've presented has you've not shown me any spectrums.
All right, that's your response. Haven't shown me any spectrums. I said I think that it is very highly hypocritical of you to go on other talk shows, and yes, I do listen to other talk radio. You know, I spend a lot of time with talk radio. So for you to go on another show and blast me, you know, in sort of that sickening little laugh that people attach to anything that approaches this kind of subject, and tell this other talk show host, well, thank God you don't talk about that kind of thing, like that crazy bell or whatever it was you said, and then to come on this program and pick as your topic the precise thing that you criticized is about as hypocritical as a person can get. Have a good morning. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Art.
Hi.
Now, I was thinking, you know, in the schools, if they would put in teaching like entrepreneurship.
Yes.
Put in Hooked on Phonics and Beyond Phonics so the kids come out learning. You know?
I know.
It would be great. And another thing, people can buy land, but then what happens when they come in and start to farming? If they run over a rat or they come up with this phony fairy shrimp, the fairy shrimp used to be sold in comic books as, what was the name of those little shrimp?
Little
monkeys?
Little shrimp.
Sea monkeys or something?
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah, and they found all over the world.
Oh, you're not talking about the little seahorse things, are you?
Yeah, they're fairy shrimp.
I don't know what a fairy shrimp are.
Fairy shrimp.
And I know about the rats and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
I know, they go too far.
I know. And another thing, you know, on the bait, on the David Koresh thing, they said they accused him of molesting children, right?
Mm-hmm.
But according to some of the people who was around, Koresh says that is not true.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't they use the BTF to go in on Mambla? See, David Koresh is politically correct, but Mambla is...
No, you've got it backwards.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's,
you know
good,
what I mean.
It's a good question. The,
yeah, Mambla...
North American Man-Boy Love Association.
Yeah, why don't the BTF go on something like that, then?
You know, that's a really good question, and I don't have a really good answer.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Where are you, by the way?
Oh, San Francisco, Al.
San Francisco, all right, thank you. You know, he's got an awfully good point. I mean, Mambla is an organization devoted to, by its name tells it all, the North American Man-Boy Love Association. So I wonder if the BATF has investigated that. Rolled some tanks on their headquarters or something. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Art. How you doing? It's Bryce in Wichita.
Hi, Bryce.
KFH.
Yes, sir.
First of all, I wanted to express concern. I haven't heard Leonard call on any talk shows across the nation at all. I wonder if he's okay.
Well, that's unknown. You're right. You're
talk
absolutely
radio,
right.
Leonard, he's ubiquitous. He's on every. He used to be on everywhere. But anyway, I got a question for you, Art.
You know, if Leonard has died, you think he's up there?
Yeah, I think he is. Leonard was always consistent. You know. Leonard never, you know, I kind of liked hearing him because he was always consistent.
Do you think that Leonard was a compelled preacher?
Oh, very much so.
And I wonder, do you think that somebody like that has a better chance of getting to heaven than somebody who is simply quietly devoted to their God?
I have no idea on a question like that.
Damn,
I wanted to
damn
ask
good
you,
question.
Sir.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you, Art.
Yes?
After Whitewater hearings are over and the Waco hearings over and such, and they don't find anything, or they find a little bit, but this, you know, it's no big deal, really. What is a conspiracy theorist going to do? Is it going to be a backlash then against the Republicans? I've already heard Mr. Nichols on Harder's show saying that Dole was in on the conspiracy now to keep, you know, Whitewater safe and shut, and which is ludicrous, you know.
Well, I talked to Ambassador Alan Keyes last hour. Do you hear that interview?
No, I did not.
Too bad. I asked him look, what if, let us imagine, there's something that's going to knock out President Clinton in Waco, in the Waco hearings or Whitewater? Would that be good or bad? And he admitted that would be bad because then the Democrats might actually put somebody up who could be electable.
Right.
So
right.
So there's a lot of different ways to look at, you know, at what's going on right now and what the Republicans would do if they actually came up with a smoking gun. It really is a very, very interesting question because, remember, folks, politics rules, doesn't it? So if they had the smoking gun, ask yourself, what would they do with it?
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from July 19th, 1995. Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from July 19, 1995.
Well, it's something, folks. The Roswell story is beginning to build, and I'm going to update you first on that. What we've done in the first 2 hours of the show is, hour number one was an interview with Ambassador and presidential candidate Alan Keyes. We did a full hour with Alan Keyes. If you get a repeat of the program 3 hours from now, you'll get to hear that. If you missed it, I recommend hearing it. It was a good interview. We ran him through the paces. The Roswell story is growing, and there are a lot of stations joining us at this hour, and I've got some responsibility to update them. So I'm going to give you a very quick version. This fax I found fascinating. Hello, Art. I recently downloaded all five pictures of the alien body supposedly obtained from the Roswell, New Mexico crash in 47. I've got to tell you, my first impression of the pictures really disturbed me. They seem so real. If these pictures are not authentic, then I think this is one of the best alien special effect models I've ever seen. But it appears the story of the films and pictures is beginning to get network news attention. I was watching KNXV, an ABC affiliate in Phoenix, tonight, around 10:15 Phoenix time, when a segment of the news mentioned a congressman from New Mexico requesting the Air Force release the films of the dissection of an alien body found in the wreckage of a crashed UFO in 1947. Supposedly, the Air Force reply was that the films of the dissection were just, quote, just an experiment gone wrong, end quote. Couldn't believe what I heard. Is the Air Force acknowledging something here? Maybe some listeners can confirm what I heard tonight. That's from Mel in Chandler, Arizona. And from the New Mexico newspaper, I believe, the following story on Congressman Schiff. Listen to this. It is either the scoop of the century or a very gruesome hoax. After watching a grainy 15-minute film purporting to show the autopsy of a space alien captured in Roswell in 1947, Steve Schiff is not sure. The New Mexico Republican is not exactly endorsing the footage, reportedly taken by a U.S. Army photographer on the Roswell Army Airfield in 1947. On the other hand, he's not dismissing it as bunk either. He said, quote, there is one thing for sure. If this is a hoax, it was certainly elaborately done. It looked real to me. If the footage is verifiable, Schiff says it would be the first real evidence, hard evidence, of man's contact with UFOs. So there you've got it. Congressman Schiff now beginning to get involved in this story as well. So it's growing, and the photographs are incredible, nothing short of incredible. There are two ways that I've been trying to get them to you. One is by computer. If you're a computer owner and you know how to download, you can get them from our bulletin board. They're on the Internet as well. Our bulletin board number is area code 702-727-1709. We interviewed Ray Santilli. Hope you got to hear it. He gave us specific permission to publish the Internet photographs, the five that we have, in the newsletter. They are now in the hands of the publisher, and the newsletter is getting ready to go to press. They are awesome photographs. If you don't have a computer and you want to see the photographs, having our newsletter is one way to see them. I'll be giving you the deadline, but it's coming up. In other words, you can order the newsletter now, subscribe for a year, and it's well worth the money. I mean, we cover everything on this program, Dreamland, the whole schmear, with things just like this, and have been doing it since we began the newsletter. There are interviews, there's just a raft of inside information about the network. Alan Corbett writes a monthly column on all the inside goodies going on. I write a monthly column or so, and on and on and on. The newsletter is $29.95. All five Roswell photographs are going to be in the next issue, if you order now. Bosnia is deteriorating quickly. Another safe zone has fallen, not confirmed by the UN, but they're saying they've got Zeba. There are tens of thousands more refugees on the move. The latest in a long string of ideas from the administration is when and if the Serbs move on Garajda, we go in with heavy bombing from the air, really massive bombing and airstrikes. So that is but the latest as safe zones, which ought not be called safe zones. They ought to simply be assigned target numbers, and I'm sure they are by the Serbs. They're not safe at all. The president on affirmative action wants it both ways, says there ought not be quotas, preferences, reverse discrimination, but at the same time says that why our slogan should be, what was it he said? We should have a simple slogan, mend it but don't end it. Well, how do you have affirmative action without having quotas, without having preferences? Affirmative action, by its very nature, has to have them or it is nothing. If you're not giving a preference based on a past discrimination of some kind, then what are you doing? So, I don't know what the president meant, but people clapped. Waco. The hearings are going on. Now, I'm going to say this again. It was a brilliant move on the part of the government. But still, I thought it was true, undeniably true. 14-year-old girl got up on the stand yesterday. She came to the hearings and said when she was 10, Koresh had sex with her. Gave a very graphic description and doesn't justify what they did to the children and the adults at Waco, but boy, I'll tell you what, it sure does color my impression of Koresh, because I had recalled that Janet Reno said it was for the children, that children had been molested, and then the children that came out and survived Waco and that were examined by psychiatrists were said not to have been molested, and yet here was a young gal saying indeed she was, at 10. So I wonder where in Koresh's religious philosophy it enabled him to have 10-year-olds and such, you know. It colors my impression of Koresh.
O.J. Simpson trial goes on and on and on and on. The tow truck driver who the day before said he'd towed the Bronco to the impound yard, didn't see any blood, yesterday got back up on the stand, said, well, I might not have seen it because I didn't have my glasses on. I don't see too well with my glasses. And I was sitting there thinking, well, then why is he a tow truck? You know, what's he doing out there towing anyway? There was some good news for the defense yesterday. This is pretty serious. The police camera person who went to O.J. Simpson's house and took photographs never saw a bloody sock when he filmed in Simpson's bedroom. Never saw the sock. Moreover, when the camera panned in the area where the socks should have been, they weren't there. This bolsters Simpson's claims of being set up, doesn't it? So what do you think about that? L.A. A gunman with a semi-automatic weapon who worked for the city of L.A., took a semi-automatic and killed four of his fellow workers yesterday. Police got him, though. He just went crazy and started killing a bunch of coworkers. Now, you know, my question is, do you realize how used to these stories we're beginning to get? It was one of the last stories NBC ran yesterday. And it's going to get to a point where people going on rampages with guns is not going to be big news anymore. It's just, you know, it's just going to be another guy goes on a rampage and kills coworkers story, and eventually it'll drop out of the news altogether. And at that point, I guess it has become a regular thing. Whitewater hearings also continuing to not much effect yet. So there's a lot in the news and a lot I haven't covered, and I'll sort of drop a lot of the rest of it in as we continue this morning. Right now, back to the telephones. First-time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art. This is Travis calling from Bakersfield.
Travis, speak up good and loud for us. You're not real strong.
Yes, I'm calling from Bakersfield on the mighty KNZR.
Yes, sir.
Yes, a few days ago, you had talked about the gangs in the military.
Yeah.
And it sounded like you sound kind of chilled about it.
Chilled about it is right. I was in the military. How a gang member could get through basic training and tech school and get on an aircraft carrier and start to stake out turf on an aircraft carrier is a little bit of a stretch, but I guess it's occurring.
Yes, well, I've got a little bit more news for you that might kill you a little bit more.
Great. What?
I knew about this 10 years ago.
You did?
Yes.
How?
I was in the military.
And you saw gangs?
Yes.
Gang members?
Gang
people.
Activity on base.
On base?
Yes. This was in Long Beach.
Yeah, really? I don't know why I'm laughing. I mean, it's just so incredible. The Bloods, the Crips in the Navy, the Marines. We got some Marine Crips, do we?
Yes.
I find that almost impossible to believe. I appreciate your call, and I guess I shouldn't doubt it, because God knows anything is possible these days. But I just, you know, I know about the Marine Corps, and it seems impossible to believe. I suppose it could occur maybe out at sea, maybe on an aircraft carrier. But even there, you know, I can't imagine it. Gangs in the military. Gangs in the military. Well, at least they'll be trained well, huh? East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. This is Joe from Niles.
Hi, Joe from Niles. What's going on?
Well, the reason why I called you, I heard the most disturbing news on the radio on the news break. You know, that Susan Smith trial?
Yes, uh-huh.
They wouldn't even show the pictures to the jury when they were taking the car out of the lake. One of the little baby's hands was on the window. It made me sick. You know, the way I feel, they should give her the same kind of death.
Death, huh?
Put her in the back of the car.
Joe?
Strap her in. And
Joe?
Yep.
Joe? Do you think that when she committed that crime, she was crazy?
Yes.
You do.
Definitely.
So then you are in favor of executing crazy people.
Well, no, really.
You're not?
Well, yes, in a way, because...
Well, you can't be in a way with... We're talking about life and death here. Either you're going to strap her in, as you just said, and roll her into the river the way they were.
That's the way they should choose. They should let go. You know, my father was a police officer for 30 years back home in my hometown. And he said when anybody takes their own life or shoots somebody else, at the time they do it, they're crazy.
All right, thank you. Well, you know, there is something to that. At that moment, whenever they pull the trigger, tighten the carotid artery, choke the life out of somebody, you know, roll them into the river or whatever, at that moment, they are crazy. And so I am asking and have been asking, should we... Is temporary insanity, should temporary insanity, be a legal defense? Yes or no? You're saying really whether or not we ought to be executing crazy people. I mean, I think she probably was. At the moment she did that, I think she was nuttier than a fruitcake. And now, so how does that bear on what the punishment really ought to be? West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning. Hello.
West of the Rockies.
That's where, well, aren't you west of the Rockies?
Yes, Seattle.
Well, that's west of the Rockies.
Okay. I want to talk to you about grenades.
Grenades, all right.
Yes, during the Waco hearings, it seemed awfully convenient.
Which category on grenades do you want? $100, $200, $500?
I'll take grenades for $500.
Grenades for $500, all right.
I think it was just a little too convenient that the package just happened to break open. And the United Parcel man just happened to call the ATF and let them know about the grenade package being supposedly delivered to the compound.
But these, wait a minute now, these were not live grenades.
Oh, I know, they were just metal casings.
Well, so
what? Is there anything against the law having metal casings? I don't think so.
I've got one of them myself.
Yeah, according to that guy, he said he's never even heard of one as being a paperweight, which seemed kind of funny to me. But anyway, another thing I wanted to talk about. You had a poll, or someone had a poll that said 52% of the people don't trust the government.
Yeah.
I think that number should be a lot higher because the people doing the poll were probably paranoid in the first place and didn't really want to admit the truth. That's probably a lot higher.
You're probably right, sir. Thank you. I do. I've got a... It's not a real grenade, of course. Maybe it was once. It's got a hole drilled in the bottom of it. But it still looks to all the world like a real grenade. And I don't think there's anything wrong with grenade casings. It's when they're filled with, well, I guess you can't really have grenades, live grenades, right? I don't think you can. Sure you can't. I remember, I'm hesitant to tell this story, but I will. Back in the days when I worked for KDWN in Las Vegas... one day I brought my grenade in, and they were doing a two-person talk show there, and I almost can't even remember who the two were. At any rate, I just slid the studio door open, and I rolled this grenade into the room. You know, kind of went tumbling over and over and came to rest on the floor right in front of the both of them. And... it really did elicit quite a reaction. I really, of course, you don't play those kind of practical jokes anymore, but I did do that, and I've done actually worse. I have a sad, sick propensity for enjoying practical jokes. Though, believe me, I've had enough played on me, so there's been proper vengeance, I'm sure. No, I never will forget that. Actually, the expression on their faces, well... It just can't, there's not a word picture in radio that can convey it properly. But when you're a talk show host and you see a grenade rolling across your floor, it was really pretty dirty tricky. Wildcard line, you're on the air. Hi.
Charlie, liberal in California.
Yeah.
First of all, I want to congratulate Bill Clinton on making the correct decision on affirmative action. I know there's a lot of idiots out there who don't realize that we still do need affirmative action. And
maybe you can explain what he didn't seem to be able to, Charles, and that is, how do you say no quotas, no special privilege, but we're going to keep affirmative action? What is affirmative action, Charles?
Because affirmative action is basically goals. They're not specific specific numbers.
Well, so you mean there are goals that may not be enforced in any way whatsoever, correct?
Well, I think that's true to extent, but I think here's what the problem is. There is still racism out there.
The president's position means
don't understand that concept. I know that's over your head.
Yeah.
I know that your basic concept of justice means just that, just us, right wing white people.
Really?
But the bottom line is this: if there is racism out there, then certainly people who are applying for jobs, we certainly should be able to open some doors so those people can get through.
How do we do that? How do we do that?
I think we do that by keeping the doors of education open that Republicans, extremist Republicans like yourself, want to close by cutting education. And I think we do that by certainly opening some doors to some federal contract.
Wait a minute now. That's a quota, if not a preference.
I love it when you bring your voice up a few octaves. That means you're trying to make a weird conservative point.
Really?
You mean
it's an untruth? You mean that to give a preference is not to give a preference.
Look, let me tell you.
Congratulations. You're making every bit as much sense as the president did yesterday.
Let me tell you something. There are thousands and thousands of companies out there. Most of them are white. There are very few minority companies. Certainly, we can open a door. We can open some doors for some minority companies, and we can say, "Hey, we have room for them." I do not understand why you guys want absolutely everything
Charlie,
in this country.
Charles, do you hear that music? I have a break coming up now. I might be tempted to let you debate somebody on this. Because you're so obnoxiously incorrect.
Well, if you can
incorrect.
Find somebody intelligent enough, it might be kind of difficult.
Hold on. Stay right where you are. Any intelligent folk who would like to debate the man who, like the president, makes no sense at all on this, come now. We'll do it after the break.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from July 19th, 1995. Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired July 19th, 1995.
At 192 affiliates, adding WAZL Hazleton, Pennsylvania, and KIOV in Payette, Indiana. Boy, we're getting big. Fast. Going over 200 soon, and we will party. At 200, we will party. All right, I said it was coming. It was inevitable. Here it is. Sir Charles the Ridiculous is prepared to defend the president's position on affirmative action. It's really interesting. I just don't understand how you have it without having it. But if ever there was a president adept at having his cake and eating it too, it is Bill Clinton. So let's, I can't remember who's where. Who's on this? Oh, I can
Charlie,
tell.
Charlie,
yeah,
hello?
I can tell. Actually, your breathing gives you away, Charlie.
I'm sorry.
You're a mouth breather. All right. Here's DJ in Phoenix. Subject, affirmative action, and the president had to say about subject in general. DJ in Phoenix, meet Charles the
infamous.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. DJ, go right ahead.
Well, good evening to you, Charlie, and I'll make you a deal right up front.
The DJ,
I'll call you any names. I won't call you any names.
Well, you can't cut a deal like that.
The word is don't act like any names, and you won't have any problems.
DJ, speak up good and loud, or you're going to get buried by this guy.
Okay.
All right.
So why should we keep affirmative action, Charlie?
We should keep affirmative action because we still need affirmative action. We still need protection for minority groups. We still have racism in this country. And the problem is that we don't know where that racism is. And when you have minorities generally having to go to the white power structure and ask them for jobs, we need to make sure that those people have equal ground to compete. And affirmative action is a way of doing that.
Don't we have minority representation in the Congress? Don't we have minority representation in the Senate?
You can say we have some.
Don't we have minorities in the presidential cabinet?
Actually, that's not as true as it used to be, thanks to that Supreme Court ruling.
And this president isn't doing his job for the minorities, is he?
You asked the question. The problem is that when a black person is going to qualify, say, as a police officer, or a black company wants to get a certain contract, that company generally, or that black person generally, has to go to a white person and ask that white person for a job. Now, let me make my point. If that white person happens to dislike black people, have a cousin who happens to be a buddy of his that he wants to push up a couple notches, and guess what? That minority person is not going to get that position.
Well, guess
that's
what, Charlie? It happens to white people, too. It happens to Asian people. It happens to black people. It happens to Hispanic
people. Of course it happens to people, and it's not...
I'm sure it's happened to you before. It's called nepotism,
it's
not
called
racism.
Whatever
nepotism.
The hell it's called, we have to protect certain people in society.
Why do they deserve preferential treatment over anyone else? Aren't
that's not
all men created equal?
This is what I don't understand about...
According to the Constitution of the United States of America, all men are created equal.
That's true.
Regardless of their color.
That's true. And
why
does
anyone
and
deserve or need preferential treatment, Charlie?
There happens to be
explain to me why
bigotry.
Someone needs preferential treatment.
There happens to be something called bigotry that still
exists
in society.
It has always been there, and it will always be there. Those people are wrong, whether they know it or not, and it doesn't make any difference.
Less than it was, say, 30 years ago. You agree with that?
I've got news for you, Charlie. There is no law against racism.
There is a law against racism. You don't think there's a law against racism? I'll tell you what. You buy an apartment complex and write Spicks or Spaniards allowed, and see how fast before you get your butt sued if you don't
think
there's a law against
racism. That's called discrimination, Charlie. That's not racism.
Well,
discrimination is a result of racism. Racism is a thought. It is an idea.
Once you start putting that idea in motion,
you can only enforce laws against the result of racism.
People's opportunity, that's where I have a problem with it, and we have to do something about it. We cannot allow people, skilled people, not to get positions that they are generally qualified for.
Why do we have to do anything about it?
This is what I love about you, right-wing knuckleheads. I love this part about when somebody else is being denied their rights, when somebody else can't get a job because of their color, all of a sudden you guys scream, oh, we shouldn't do anything about that, because basically your philosophy is this. As long as I'm protected, as long as my rights are protected, I don't give a damn about the person who might be a couple notches down on the economic ladder, somebody else. I only care about my own rights.
Nobody promised everything would be hunky-dory and peachy keen.
You have the right to pursue happiness.
No one guaranteed happiness. They guaranteed you the right to pursue it. And if you don't make it, that's your tough luck.
Let me tell you what our society did promise. It did promise that you're not going to be denied a job because of the color of your skin. It is wrong in this society, and we still need to do something about it. You guys might want to turn your back on racism and let people be denied jobs because of the color of their skin, but we're not going to do it. We believe that everybody in society should have an opportunity, not just certain people.
About the people that do not get those jobs because of the color of their skin that happens to be opposite of that which is favored by affirmative action. What about those people's rights, Charlie?
Why don't you name their rights too?
All men are created equal. Why don't you name
one segment in American society where the minorities outnumber the white people in that segment, and I'd be glad to address it.
If someone happens to be less than 50% does not qualify them for a minority status.
If you look at every single law enforcement agency, and I've done this, in Southern
and you'll find a person of color in every single one.
The majority of people at the power structure, most of the supervisors are white men. I took a fireman's test about 4 years ago. I didn't even talk to a black. I wasn't interviewed by a black person. I didn't see a black person.
Maybe you were there on the wrong day, Charlie. Did you go back and find out if there was anyone in that position that happened to be out sick that day?
No, I'm just dealing with something. Did you even bother to find out? I'm just dealing with something that you conservatives don't know a damn thing about.
What, hypotheticalism?
The reality is this. White people generally control this society, which is fine. There's more white people than black people.
Is it fine? Now all of a sudden it's fine, is it?
Having said that, a black person who is going out to get a job should not be in fear that he's not going to get that job because of the color of his skin.
And why should a white person go out and be in fear that they are not going to get that job because of the color of their skin?
I don't care what the color of someone's skin is.
Well, that's not the issue.
That's good for you. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people.
How do you know what's good for me, Charlie? You have no idea what color my skin is.
I don't give a damn what color your skin is, but unfortunately, there are a lot of people in society that do. That's what the problem is. As soon as we get rid of racism in society, we won't need to protect people on that level.
You will never get rid of racism, Charlie, because racism is an idea.
Well, all you can do is try to educate people. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people...
And the only thing that you are doing is digging your own affirmative action grave because you are really angering those racists out there that really believe in their hardcore heart. This is what I don't like about you conservatives.
You're really angering those racists out there. I don't give a damn if I anger some damn racist out there. You hear me, racists out there? I could care less if you're angry at me. If you deny a person a job because of the color of your skin, you are wrong. And we're not going to sit down and let you do that. As much as I hate to admit that I agree with you, Charlie, on that particular point, I do agree with you.
However, under the eyes of the law, if you break the law, you go to jail. It doesn't matter what color your skin is. It doesn't matter what income level you have. It doesn't matter what your national origin is. It doesn't even matter what language you speak. You go to jail. That is equal justice.
It's supposed to be the same thing in the workplace. It should be the same thing. And why is that not so? The problem in the workplace is that what happens is that when you have certain people who decide who gets those jobs, if we don't say that some people, because of the color of their skin, there should be some doors open to them, they're going to say, hey, you know what? Maybe my Uncle Charlie should get that contract. He really needs it. You know something? I was living in the city and two black people mugged me the other day, so those black people can't be trusted, so maybe they shouldn't get a job. Now, you know good and well that because I'm white and I know that white people talk like that in private, don't they?
Well, that certainly is a racist thing for you to say, Charlie.
I know that white people, I happen to be white. My uncle says stuff like that. And I certainly, if he had to decide between a black person getting a contract and a white person, he's going to pick a white person.
Well, that's his prerogative, isn't it? He's the one hiring that person for his business, isn't he?
Not if it's a federal contract.
Well, then you have to play by a different set of rules, don't you?
Exactly, and that's what Bill Clinton is talking about.
Yes, you do.
And
now, let's say, for example, Charlie, if you're... All right.
I'm getting into the middle of this now. Time's up. Thank you both very much. That was a good, spirited debate subject worth giving it a little bit of time. So I did. And you're welcome to comment on it, and we'll be back with more. Now to another subject. You'll all recall the story of Ghost, my cat. Maybe you all don't recall it, but It was tragic, awful. I had a cat who some total jerk came whizzing by my house where we really don't have stray animals and threw it out of a moving car, and it took refuge under my home, crawled through a little block of cinder block hole, and it was kind of like a Roadrunner cartoon for days and days. I tried to catch this cat. I tried to trap it in various ways and means. Wonderful lady in Los Angeles sent me a have-a-heart trap, and finally, without going and describing all the pain I went through, I got Ghost and took Ghost the next day down to the vet to get shots and all that sort of thing so I could make Ghost a pet, give it a home. Turned out it had feline leukemia as, like, one of the worst calls I ever got from anybody. Ghost had feline leukemia, and we had to put her down. God, it was sad. Just a cat, I know, but it was really sad. So then I went down to the animal shelter, adopted a cat, which I now have named Shadow. Shadow is the lover of the world, and she crawls up. That's how I found Shadow. She crawled up on me, all the way up me, nestled in my shoulder and started licking my ear, and, you know, so it was like she chose me. It was an obvious choice, and it's worked out well. But the result, the end result of the whole thing was, I said, look, if you got a couple extra bucks, send them off to the Prump Animal Shelter. Because when I was down there, I saw these people were buried, you know. They had no more room for dogs and cats. We are the largest county in Nevada, second or third largest in the whole country. Big county. Big responsibility. A lot of animals. Not enough money. Not enough people to help. Not enough of anything. So I said, if you got a couple bucks in Ghost memory, send it off. This is one of the letters that arrived from those of you that sent in a couple of bucks. Dear friends at the Pahrump Valley Animal Shelter, I am a white kitty with blue eyes. Someone dumped me out on the street a long time ago, and fortunately for me, a nice lady came by, picked me up, took me home with her. At first I was scared, but then I realized I was riding in a nice new Cadillac that was white and had blue leather seats. I knew right then that I had nothing to fear. I was absolutely stunning in that car. My adopting mother drove me to my new home, a rambling ranch-style house perched atop a hill, surrounded by about 3 acres of wonderful property, all kinds of grass, bushes, trees, pretty flowers, and my very own bubbling fountain in the front yard. This is now my territory to take care of, which I do religiously every day. It's a big job, but I manage it quite well with the help of my friends, the raccoons, foxes, possums, skunks, lizards, little garden snakes, and birds. Oh, lots of birds. When I get too hot, I scratch on the screen, and my mother lets me in where it's air-conditioned. If it's rainy or windy, or if I get cold, one scratch on the screen gets me inside where it's warm and dry. If I'm wet, I get a rub down with a big old fluffy towel, and of course, I've got my own private dining area where I'm never given anything except that which pleases my palate. My parents know I simply won't eat anything I don't like, so there's no need giving it to me. It took a long time to train them, but they've finally gotten the message. By the way, I sleep with them in their king-size bed, too. Got my own foam rubber pillow, which is placed right between theirs. They worry about me if I'm out at night. About once a year, I have to go get shots. I hate it when that happens. Oh, well, that's life in the big city. I was listening to Art Bell tonight with my mother, and I heard about Ghost. It made me cry. The same fate could have happened to me. I asked my mother if we couldn't do something to help the other little animals and the nice people at Pahrump. She said she thought that's a good idea. So here's our check. I hope lots and lots of other people will send something in, too. This could really be a great thing. Now I'm thinking that just maybe Little Ghost was not really an Earth kitty at all. I'm thinking that just maybe Little Ghost was really an angel kitty, put here just temporarily to perform a good deed that couldn't be accomplished any other way. Stop and think about it. If you were an angel kitty, where would you go
to get the word out. Well, you'd make a nuisance of yourself right under Art Bell's house. Stay under there being cute and clever. Just long enough to become famous all over the United States and have everybody all concerned about you. You just thought you put Ghost to sleep. No, no, no. Ghost had everything planned. She simply checked out, said mission accomplished. She hasn't got the time to hang around there any longer. Other animal shelters need help too. She's somewhere else now, putting the same act on again and again. When she gets tired, she'll quit and let someone nice find her and take her home, just like I did. Sincerely, Snowball. And there are some cat paw marks at the bottom of the paper. And, I thought that was so touching that I thought it was worth reading on the air. And so there you have it. It's typical. Here's another one, very short. This one, very short. Hi. This is from a 92-year-old blind lady who only has $595 a month. She's a darling, happy lady. Listens to radio all night. This pleases her and is like giving herself a birthday present. You might thank her on the radio. Thanks, Judy. So thank you. Thank you all. And I suppose one more time, I will give out the address of the Pahrump Animal Shelter. So, as I said, in the memory of this incredible, it was quite an odyssey, all right, but in the memory of this cat and for others, you might send them a couple bucks. I promise you this, they're going to build a new animal shelter area for cats. And I promise you, when it is built and it's about to begin, from what you have sent, I will take photographs of it, and I will publish them for you. It is the Pahrump Animal Shelter, Post Office Box 460, that's Post Office Box 460, in Pahrump. Do not laugh at the name of my town. I'm going to spell it for you. It's P-A-H-R-U-M-P. P-A-H-R-U-M-P, Nevada. Zip code 84041. I hope that's right. That was scratched out here. 84041. So, one more time, anybody who's willing, a couple bucks is just great, to the Pahrump Animal Shelter in memory of Ghost. Post Office Box 460, Pahrump, Nevada. P-A-H-R-U-M-P, zip code, I think, 84041. And I'm going to check on that. If I've got to correct that zip code, it doesn't feel right. Maybe it is. But if I've got to correct that zip code, I will do so. And again, to all of you who donated and made possible what's about to happen, which is going to save many, many animals from me, and I'm sure from Ghost, thank you. We'll be right back with more from the high desert. I'm Art Bell.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from July 19, 1995. Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired July 19th, 1995.
I'm really stuck on this piece of music. This has happened to me with more Cusco. I hear it, then I hear it again, then about the third time, I get stuck. I love this. I absolutely love this piece of music. God, it's so different. It's so good for the soul. It's just good music. Isn't that nice? Anyway, welcome back. Final live hour. Then those radio stations that go on and take the a repeat of the first portion of the show that many times has been missed will get a repeat of the interview with Ambassador Keyes, presidential candidate Alan Keyes. Very dynamic individual. And one station that is going to be carrying that, there's a big surprise. In fact, let me again repeat, KDXU in St. George, Utah now carries the show, and they're doing it early. It was due to begin, we thought, around the 26th, but lo and behold, there we are. So let me hold open my toll-free line for about a half hour here, west of the Rockies, for people in or hearing St. George, Utah, 890 on the dial, 890. And so if you are one of the people hearing St. George, Utah on 890, brand new, I don't know, this morning, maybe they were here yesterday, I don't know. Anyway, they're here. So if you're listening on KDXU, 890 on the dial, from St. George, Utah, big signal, give us a call at 1-800-618-8255. Everybody else, please hold off and let the listeners of KDXU get through. The number again, 1-800-618-8255. We'll find out when we came on there. Maybe it was just tonight. I mean, who knows? East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes.
Where are you, sir?
I'm in Montana.
Montana. Okay.
And I believe in re-embodiment and mercy and justice. And I like to talk about the Smith murders. I think that in any case, anybody who's impaired by being insane on a permanent or temporary basis is still responsible for their actions.
Well, that's the argument, of course, are they?
And,
Have you ever... let me stop you. Have you ever been crazy?
Have I ever been crazy?
Yeah.
Probably in another embodiment, I have been.
Well, forgetting other embodiments, I'm talking about this one. Has there ever been...
You mean angry enough to do something?
I mean utterly, totally out of damn control. Have you ever been in that state? Out of control?
No, not this embodiment.
Well, I have.
Uh-huh.
And I think most people have.
You mean where you would actually...
Where you're absolutely not responsible for what you do. I mean, you're just nuts.
Okay. I don't know what you've done when you were in that state, so it's a little hard to respond to your comment about it.
It's not a matter of what was done.
Uh-huh.
It's a matter of that loss of control. I'm just asking you, have you ever been to that state, that kind of loss of total control? And you said no. That's
not,
fair
not in this embodiment I have.
Okay.
I've gotten really, really angry.
Angry, yeah.
Yeah.
But I admit it. There have been a couple of times in my life I flat lost it. And so I'm thoughtful on the matter. In other words, because I can remember at those times I probably could have killed. I probably could have done anything. I probably could have committed suicide. I lost it about twice.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's happened to a lot of people. And so
I agree. I think that has happened, you know, to a lot of people.
But that's not a defense.
I don't think so, no. I think that when it comes down to the bottom line, you're responsible for your actions, even if you're permanently insane.
Crazy, uh-huh.
And the reason I say that is because if you're really insane on a permanent or a temporary basis, you're still responsible for putting yourself in that situation. Now, I know people are going to argue, well, what if you were abused and so on and so on and so on.
Yeah.
But perhaps people that were abused, in fact, were abusers in other embodiments.
Maybe.
And that's their lesson learning.
Well, I'd rather talk about present embodiments.
Yeah, I understand. No problem.
So,
I can do that.
So, okay, then by extension,
you support execution of those people.
Exactly. And, you know, the thing is, if you believe they have the opportunity to come back, that means they can come back with a clean slate.
Well, okay, we were going to stick, thank you, with this embodiment, thank you. So maybe next time they'll be back. I don't care about next time or last time. Right now we're discussing this time, this body, this life, you know. West of the Rockies, actually on my KDXU line, you're on the air. Hello.
Good evening. This is Big Daddy. I'm in Ivins, Utah.
Ivins, Utah?
Yeah, right next to St. George.
Well, then, in that case, maybe you can tell me, when did we start showing up on 890?
This is the first time I picked you up. I've been digging you out of the fuzz out of San Diego.
So this is coming in a lot stronger, needless.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. KDXU is coming in well. I couldn't get you on KDON very well. It was in and out from this location.
Oh, KDXU, listen, Utah is a very difficult area. We have an affiliate, of course, in Salt Lake and some others, but St. George was a big old empty spot, and it, boy, does it get filled by KDXU.
I'll say on the Waco testimony today.
Yes.
The young lady testimony was quite riveting. However, under what provision does alcohol, tobacco, and firearms have anything to do with sexual cases in the state?
Technically, they don't. In fact, even the FBI wouldn't, unless a minor had been carried across state lines. The involvement of the BATF and the FBI and the military was justified by federal weapons alleged violations. It was justified by alleged drug activity. There was a report, accurate or not, of a methamphetamine lab possibly being there. I never saw any methamphetamine, did you? But that got the military involved. That's why you're able to go around Posse Comitatus and get the military involved. So there you go. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello. Hello there.
Hi.
Hi.
Is this Art?
Yes.
Okay. Hey,
Absolutely.
Over here in Carmel, California. This is George.
Hi, George.
Right next to Monterey, right on the coast, and I'm getting 890.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
So then there's signal.
Now, I don't know when it came on, but we're getting it.
Well, I don't know when it came on either. I'm always surprised by these things. I mean, I knew it was coming, like, on the 26th it was planned for, but we're there early. So.
I've been listening to you for about 7 or 8 years, first time I called you, but here's something that you might want to think about.
All right.
And that has to do with the militias that were organized in the wheat-growing country about 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
when the sheriffs were trying to foreclose on homes.
Yes, uh-huh.
It was the standard middle-class guy raising a family, trying to get his kids to college.
Sure.
And a lot of it happened because there was a Cold War with Russia, and the federal government put up a lot of money to subsidize these people
mm-hmm.
so that we could sell wheat to Russia to have them dependent upon this country
yep.
for their food supply. And the consequence was that some of these people overspent, which is a normal human characteristic. When you have good times, and wheat went to $5
a
bushel, and no one ever thought it would ever go that high.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the subsidies were taken off, the heavy loans and mortgage against the farm tried to be foreclosed, and the sheriff would come out to try to collect the property and all
yeah,
the farmers.
So what was the result of this? I mean, was there a gigantic clash?
I don't know.
Were farms protected from foreclosure by the militias? How did it all end up?
Well, they tried to scare the sheriff off, and I can't give you the final detail, but I do know that that was an origin of some of the militias.
All right, sir. Thank you. I'll tell you something else, too. There are areas now where militias are very predominant, where the sheriff and local law enforcement people are frightened to have to deliver some sort of legal paper, where, in fact, they will not. So that sort of begins to establish a kind of a, what? Sort of a little, little areas of kingdoms within the country, little armed camps that actually are able to prevent what otherwise would be a legal service, because everybody knows they got a whole bunch of guns there and they're probably willing to use them. Sure, it'd probably cause anybody, sheriff otherwise, to think twice, I would think. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Yes, Art, how you doing? This is J.R. from Chico, California.
Chico, California. Well, that's KPAY country.
Yes, and I went over to the band for that radio station in Utah, and lo and behold, it was there.
Yeah, that's, it was there. It's kind of a minor cheat to do it that way, but...
It's I believe, as we say, within the boundary of the law.
Well, it's yes, it is, but boy, I'll tell you, it's gray area. All right, so anyway, what's on your mind?
I want to talk about this 14-year-old girl and her situation of making the accusation against David
Koresh.
Koresh.
Yes, uh-huh.
To my knowledge, and I'd like to put this out to you, there was absolutely no evidence that this ever happened, correct? In other words, they didn't have... i.e. semen samples or pictures or that.
No.
It's just her evidence,
yeah,
correct?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're entering into an area where if I said over the air, excuse me, Mr. Art Bell, I'm bringing you to court because you sexually molested me,
mm-hmm.
What weight would that have?
Well, I doubt that it would get to court, because in order to make that accusation, you would have to go to the police, then ultimately the district attorney, who would make bring charges against me if there was sufficient evidence. If not, it would never get to court.
But
so we're not discussing a court matter here.
You bet, but somehow, because if a girl is making an accusation, that's all it is,
you know,
is now somehow it's validated that Koresh molested children.
Well, only insofar as people are willing to believe what she said.
Yeah, but I think you said that.
I said that her testimony mm-hmm. affected the way I thought about Koresh. And it did.
Well, see, that's exactly my point, is you have to have a discipline not to think like that.
No, you don't.
Well, yes, you do.
No, you don't, though.
Well,
I'm allowed to think anything. I'm allowed to think anything I want. I didn't come on the air and say David Koresh is obviously guilty of child molestation because of what she said. I never said that.
You said that it influenced
my opinion. Perception. My opinion of David Koresh. That's correct. I stand by that.
Exactly. And what I'm saying is that we have to be disciplined against that. And the
No, we don't, and I don't want to listen to the reason. There is no reason. I'm allowed to think that, and I am thinking that. That doesn't mean that I think Koresh necessarily absolutely did it, or, boy, did she ever convict him of child molestation. I didn't say that either. I said I tended to believe what she said. Yeah, I think she was coached, but I think she was telling the truth. And so, that's just, I think. It's not he's convicted of, it's just I was affected by that testimony. I admit it. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
Where are you?
I'm in Kansas City.
Kansas City, yes, sir.
And I'm old Joe.
Old Joe?
And
how old are you, Joe?
Oh, God, my bones hurt. I'm old, but I'm just barely 59.
59? You're not old, Joe.
I know. I'm going over the hump this fall.
Anyway, what's on your mind?
Well, one of the main differences between the Mexican population and the American population as far as fomenting a revolution is concerned is that...
You didn't call earlier, did you?
No.
No? Sounds like an extension of my earlier call. The difference is?
The difference is that we're not disarmed yet.
Well, that's true.
And
for that matter, the Mexicans are not really... There's a lot of guns in Mexico, sir. I mean...
There also is an unreported revolution.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, thank you. Yeah, that's true. There's a lot of guns in Mexico. What do the people think? There are no guns in Mexico? Wrong-o. Now there are fewer guns to the north in Canada. I wouldn't say they've been exactly disarmed either, but it's pretty well along the way up there. Well, there's a lot of guns in Mexico. Plenty of guns. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, are you still holding this for KDXU listeners?
Yes, I am.
I'm calling from near Santa Rosa, California, where you also have a station, but I was just checking to pick it up, and sure enough, it's there.
Well, look, thanks for the report, and if you have something quick to say, go ahead. But I was really kind of, I guess I was hoping to get mainly people up there in Utah hearing it for the first time, and of course, there you are at one of our regular affiliates.
Yeah, well, I pick you up on about 12 or 13 different stations from here.
Yeah, you're
I
in
have
the
an
middle.
Old ATS 803. That I use.
Hey, that's a great radio.
Yeah, it is.
Well, all right, sir. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call, but that kind of escapes slightly the spirit of what I'm saying here. I'll do this till the bottom of the hour. Take people listening to KDXU, just sort of celebrating the fact that they're there. On my KDXU line, you're on the air.
Hi, Art.
Okay, turn your radio off.
Oh, it's going
that's
off.
Number one, turn the radio off.
Just was listening to your conversation. I know you're trying to get Utah, but I just wanted to say
No. See, you're cheating. That's cheating. See, I'm holding the line open for KDXU. On my KDXU line, you're on the air. Are you there? No. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Sir, out of Nye. Good morning. This is Sky.
New Orleans, yes.
Yes, sir. Boy, Charlie Lilber had me laughing earlier, I tell you.
Well, that was a good one, wasn't it?
Who was that guy in Phoenix?
DJ.
DJ, this is for you. I commend you. You were fantastic. You blew his fecal matter out of the proverbial water. Yeah. I mean, he reminded me of me. That was he spoke with fact, and Charlie, like all of them, don't want to be confused with fact or misled with the truth. They go ballistic.
Right. Mm.
Just can't handle it. And I got a theory about Charlie. Like, I think it's one of two. Either he's practicing for public office and he wants to get, you know, the liberal vote, of course, or he's a stealth conservative.
A stealth conservative?
Yes, he's playing that role.
Oh, I see, in order to actually help the conservative cause. Don't think that hasn't occurred to me. But the trouble is, he does it too well.
You can tell it's him to the core.
Yeah, that's it. It really is to the core. All right, sir, thank you. No, I believe that. I used to think Charlie was actually trying to do damage to the Democrats with his rhetoric. And one might imagine that. But no, I'll tell you, it's the truth. He believes, incredibly as it may seem, what he mouths. West of the Rockies, you're on the air.
Good morning, Art. How are you doing?
Okay, sir.
This is David Morting again. I was listening to Charlie's debate a little bit, and he sounded like he was back in the 60s and 70s. I think he'll never get up to the 90s at all. I was talking to a young man. He was a entrepreneur, and he's a Black American, and we talked about the affirmative action thing a little bit. And he said it was good for the 60s and 70s, but now there's too many stuff in the books or on the law books to correct that if something does happen into that area.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he was talking about. So the idea is now is to focus on, you know, on people that are handicapped or something like that. That's what, you know, it was originally for in the first place.
All right, sir. Thank you. No, it wasn't. It was originally to correct past discrimination, severe discrimination. And I think that affirmative action at one time was justified. I think that time is over. And I think the focus now should be clearly on equal rights and equal opportunity. And I can't recall who said it, but whoever he was correct. I have no objection to laws that demand equal opportunity. Opportunity, chance, competitive fair ground. I support that sort of thing, but not preferential treatment. And I can't see how you can have your cake and eat it too, unless you're Bill Clinton. In other words, we shouldn't have quotas, we shouldn't have preferences, but we should have affirmative action. That's a ridiculous statement on the face of it. Affirmative action is quotas and preference.
or it is nothing but two words, affirmative action, and means nothing. So, yeah, you're darn right. I enjoyed hearing Charlie wiggle. It was very, very entertaining. There's simply no case there. We're going to break here at the bottom of the hour. I want one more call from a listener to KDXU in St. George, Utah, which slipped in as an affiliate. 890 on the dial, big signal, on the west of the Rockies line, 1-800-618-8255.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from July 19, 1995. Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from July 19, 1995.
Good morning, everybody. Open line, unscreen talk radio. This is it. From Bryn Mawr in San Francisco, for what it's worth, I can hear St. George here in San Francisco. Congratulations. And, yes, I've been so angry I've lost complete control, only for a few seconds at a time. But there is a state of being that is blinding. Fortunately, most of us can avoid that frame of mind for long periods of time. Apparently, Susan Smith cannot. It really is a very interesting topic. Here's my one more call from up in Utah. Where?
Ivins.
Ivins, Utah. Listening to KDXU. Here you are. Welcome to the program.
Oh, well, thank you. But I was able to get through.
Well, it's because I held this line open. So you're the last one who's made it through without competition from the rest of the West. But I wanted to celebrate, you know, the new station.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, you have a good talk radio station going on. Your signal's loud and clear.
Oh, I'll bet it is. They're running 10,000 watts on 890, and that gets around.
Yeah, it sure does.
What do you do for fun in Ivins?
Oh, for fun. Well, mostly some yard work once in a while.
Yard work.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, it's funny. As you get older, yard work actually does get to be fun. And that's how you know you're getting older, because when you were younger, oh, man, we're talking serious drudgery here. I used to have a lawn so big, sir. And I had a good mower. I had a lawn so big that when I finished mowing it, it was time to start on the first piece again.
There you go. Yeah, that's great.
Endless lawn.
Uh-huh.
All right, well, listen, thank you very much, and KDXU for sending you along. I did. That's horrible. I mean, it's horrible. A lawn so big that even going out and spending like an hour and a half, 2 hours a day, doing nothing but cutting lawn, by the time you're done, it's time to start on the first thing again, so it's like a never-ending situation. I used to pray for cold weather. Anyway, Art just spent the last half hour trying to call. Lots of busies. Think I'd rather try my chances getting through this way on fax. Couple things. I listened with great interest the other night to the interview with Ray Santilli. I thought he was eminently credible. A breath of fresh air in the UFO biz. With regard to that, and also Mr. Hoagland, since there are so many conspiracy theorists and so many theories, I wonder how you sort through it all and decide what you think is credible. Well, that's a really good question. I don't know. I sort through and try to find and present the most credible sounding things I can as we explore these areas that are arguably a little different and a little abnormal. I try to find people in these areas that sound credible. Beyond that, how do you establish the credibility of somebody making claims that cannot be
firmly established yet. You can't. So you just, you know, you sort through. That's all. Art, a question and a comment. And on to the meat of the facts here. A question. Why do we call tuna fish tuna fish? We all know that tuna is a fish. So why do we say it twice? We don't say we're going to have a steak cow for dinner or a chicken fowl, so why do we say tuna fish? I have no answer for that. And his comment. I think that all of the conspiracy theories are false. There is no trilateral commission. God, never say that. There is no one world order. It's all bunk. In fact, I think that all the conspiracy theories is a conspiracy. God, I like that, sir. And I like your comment on tuna as well. And that comes from Rick in the Dalles, Oregon. I think it's the Dalles. Isn't that the way they say it? Wildcard Line, you're on the air.
Good morning, Art.
Hello.
Greetings from Reno.
Reno.
Soon to be the home of the tallest structure in Nevada.
The tallest structure in Nevada since when?
That's the truth. You haven't heard of the Silver Legacy?
The Silver Legacy.
Opening,
you mean they're gonna make it bigger than Stupak Tower?
That's right.
Well, then Stupak has got to keep building. How much bigger than Stupak Tower is it going to be?
I can't answer that. I don't really know how many
stories
it is.
Probably classified because, you know, they know that if they were to tell Stupak how big it's going to be, Stupak would go beg for a foot or two more.
Right.
Yeah.
Say, listen, I haven't heard you make mention of any titles, suggestions for your book. I mean,
well, you know why? Because I don't want to get that started. I'll run one by you. All right?
Okay.
That I thought of. What do you think of The Art of Talk?
That's great.
Just thank you. That's just, I'm writing a book. I'm writing a book. They chased after me to write a book. So, yeah, I'm doing it. And that's just one I've thought of, The Art of Talk. But I don't know if it sufficiently says what it is. But I thought it fairly good, The Art of Talk. But see, I don't really want to get this started. That's why I'm not mentioning it. So try not to call me on the air with suggested titles for a book. Send it to me in the mail or fax it to me. Otherwise, we're going to get caught in that quagmire, and I'm never going to be able to get it stopped. Hello, Art. Loved the debate tonight. I will say this. Charlie made a very strong case for retaining the 15th Amendment, but I don't recall anybody trying to repeal that. If one were to apply the 15th Amendment in this argument, one would see that affirmative action is, by application of quotas and preferential treatments, unconstitutional. But then, that's never bothered liberals before. That's from Kevin down in Phoenix. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hi.
Good morning, Art.
Hello.
I've been trying to get a hold of you for 2 weeks. Patience
really?
Finally paid off. And
well,
I know you just got through. I just got through. Hear you saying you didn't want any suggestions for your book, but I've been...
Well, it's like, see, now you started on the air, and you can't get it stopped. It's
inside the bell.
Inside the bell.
And have a picture of a big bell, like the Liberty Bell, and have your body figure inside the bell.
Well, I'll tell you what. There's already an artist that we have who is going to do our book cover, and I'll tell you a little story about that. I've got this artist used to live in Tennessee, and he sent me as a present a work of art that he did. I mean, it was really so very good. I framed it. It's been hanging on my wall in my living room for some time now. It was tremendous. I can't describe it. I wouldn't do it justice, but suffice to say, this man has now moved to Las Vegas, and we talked the other day, and I again thanked him for this wonderful work of art. He's a commercial artist, and I told him about the book, and I said, you know, would you like to design a cover for the book? And he said, well, heck yeah. So he's going to design the cover for the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it's going to happen.
Oh, can I say one more thing?
Absolutely.
It's on your commercial on Cusco.
Yes.
I had bought the one record, Paramac 2, for myself and my grandson for graduation.
Yes.
I wanted to get him the both of them.
Right.
So I called up to find out, you know, the price, and they said it was $29.95.
Plus,
CDs. They charge you for the shipping and handling, and that cost me more than it does to buy them here in Fresno.
For CDs, though. You're buying CDs, right?
CDs, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I can get the CDs for $15.95 plus tax, and then when you by the time you pay the shipping and handling for the pair through off the special you're running, it costs more.
Well, that shouldn't be. And,
I know. That's I wanted to let you know about that.
Well, thank you.
Because you said there was tremendous savings, and there isn't. It cost you $2 more.
Maybe it depends on the store.
Maybe.
All right, thank you.
Okay, all right.
See you later. I guess that's over an average. Maybe there are some people that cut rate everything. So that could be. Well, you know, do as you will. I think getting it directly from the record label is kind of nice. And I think that you can only go by averages, and I think when they say, in fact, they do say that in the ad, on average, over the stores. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Yes, Art. I was wanting to know if I could come in on one thing about the O.J. Simpson trial.
Sure. Where are you?
Owensboro, Kentucky.
Okay.
The thing about it is that I had a problem with is when they had the videographer on there or the photographer on there.
Yes.
Shooting the camcorder.
Yes.
That was pretty late in the afternoon, and wouldn't you think Dennis Fung had done been through there and everything? Just one thing to bring up to the viewers and might want to think about it for today before they start watching it.
Well, it's possible, and if it's the case, then the prosecution is going to have to go back and obviously introduce testimony to demonstrate why those socks weren't there.
I personally believe the defense team's kind of getting slammed around, really.
Well, there's an argument that says they should never have even put on a defense, and they were ahead of the game when the prosecution got done and probably would have been guaranteed a locked-up jury. And there are those saying the defense is slowly harming themselves. Do you think they will put O.J. on, and would you if you were his attorney?
Negative. I don't think he would. And also, if I was his attorney, I wouldn't. Possibly incriminating himself, of course, you said earlier, and I perfectly agree with you there on the fact that if O.J. gets up there, he may be an actor and stuff, but when you get up there against Marcia Clark, she's one tough lady.
Oh, man.
Like your show. Keep it up the good work.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. One tough lady is right. She is. You know, I've criticized Marcia Clark a lot because I think she has a propensity to whine, and I don't like her arguments. A maid to Judge Ito, they're whiny. But when she gets on a witness, that is one whale of a woman. That came out well, actually. One whale of a woman. She really can go after somebody, a witness. She has a talent for that. She's in the right job. And it would be something to behold. Personally, I'm going to guess they are going to put him on the stand. I'll bet you. You know why? He wants to. He has told his attorneys that he wants to take the stand. Now, they can tell him no, but I don't think they can really tell him no. I mean, he's on trial for his life. If he wants to sit on that stand, ultimately he will. That's my view. We'll be right back. Wildcard Line, you're on the air.
Back to the topic of that 14-year-old girl at the Waco trial.
Yes.
I believe, like your other caller, that her testimony was false. It was as though she was reading a well-typed script.
Well, she was coached for her testimony. That does not necessarily make the story false because she was coached.
It looked as though she was either bribed or threatened to give that testimony. Just watching her face and listening to her voice, it just did not look like it was something which had happened to her.
Well, that's a fair assessment, and yours. I don't know if I agree with it.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you, sir. And, I don't know if I agree with that or not. It seems to me the probability of a little 14-year-old talking about a rape at 10. You know, I'm sure she was coached. Everybody who's going to give congressional testimony nearly is coached one way or the other about what to expect, how to approach it, and so forth and so on. And so would you be if you had to go testify in front of Congress. That doesn't make the story false, nor does it make it true. But while I watched it, it affected me. And it affected the way I think about Koresh. Because I'll say it again, previously, despite what Janet Reno's had to say, the testimony really was that Janet Reno was full of it and there was not child molestation, that sort of thing going on. Well, maybe there was, and no matter how you look at it, you've got to admit they made some points. Not in justification of going in there with gas and killing everybody. Doesn't justify that, but it justifies concern, if true. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hello, Art.
Hello.
Hey, is this Art?
Yes, where are you?
I'm John Noble, Oklahoma, USA.
Excellent.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine.
I was stationed over at Clark there. I knew you was over there. I was over there from 71, 73. Wonder if you was there about that time period.
Well, let me see. Very close.
Very close.
Very close. Clark Air Base, yes.
Yeah. I was working on radios over there, and I was going to ask you if you remember the old R390.
Of course. Did you spend more time on Clark or in Angeles City?
More time on Clark. Very few times I ever. Well, I
didn't venture into the city, huh?
Yeah, I tripped in there a few times.
Oh, I'll tell you, that was an adventure. GTs were.
Yes,
boy.
I remember there was one guy that got shot in a movie theater down there while I was there, an American.
Yeah.
And they were having all kinds of problems over there at that time. And.
Sir, there are always, always problems in the Philippines.
Just wondering about all that, Art. This is the first time I tried to call you, and I'm amazed I got through.
Well, I appreciate the call, sir. Thank you.
Okay. We'll
R390, yeah, of course I remember the R390. Great receiver. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Dr. Democrat.
Howdy.
Good morning, Art.
Good morning. I did get your second photograph, Doc. It is going to be in the book.
Oh, thank you. I imagine everybody will be impressed.
Oh, me too.
But anyhow, on this affirmative action,
yes.
Let's get something straight right away. The Supreme Court did not abolish affirmative action, okay?
Okay.
What they did is said that quotas is wrong and set-asides are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, and so Bill Clinton agrees with the Supreme Court, and that's exactly what his speech was about yesterday.
Bill Clinton is taking cover behind the Supreme Court, Doc. Why don't you tell it like it is?
Well, he's sworn to uphold the law. And so there is a middle ground on affirmative action. It's not cut and dry like you were saying. And the middle ground is this.
Yes?
That businesses should be encouraged, they should have the spirit, and they should have the goals to do what is right. And that is to hire some minorities that are qualified, because
You know what that is? That's the 1,000 points of light.
Exactly.
That's George Bush's 1,000 points of light.
And even Newt Gingrich yesterday said, we better not move too fast on this.
Uh-huh.
He knows what I know. If you divide this country, if you go back to all this race card stuff again, I don't know if we can survive it.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Anyhow, before
you
I run out of time.
We cannot survive equal opportunity. Yes, sir,
I didn't say that. I'm talking about people are really emotional about this, the minorities. And just keep in mind that America is made up, about one-third of America's population is minorities.
Mm-hmm.
And you get one-third of the people angry at society, what's going to happen to our inner cities?
Issue,
believe me.
So you're saying they'll burn our cities down.
Republicans are trying to divide us.
Uh-huh. All right, Doc, thanks. Yeah, they'll burn her. 1,000 points of affirmative action light. Yes, sir, sir. If that's what he was calling for, then that's utterly legitimate. And I have no problem with it at all. But see, I was listening to him, and he seemed to be saying to me that he wanted to change affirmative action, not eliminate it, but change it. Now, if it's utterly voluntary, if the whole thing is voluntary, then we're talking about 1,000 points of affirmative action light. And I have no problem with that at all, none whatsoever. But that just isn't what I heard our president say. And it seems to me that if you retain affirmative action, then you're saying there must be, because of the definition of it, there's got to be some sort of preference given, some sort of a quota fulfilled. It inevitably, inexorably leads to that. It must lead to that. So how do you have both? How do you have both? No, I'm sorry, Doc. I just didn't hear it as 1,000 points of light speech. I heard it as we shouldn't end it yet. I'm pretty sure that's what he said, Doc, actually. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello. Going once, going twice, going three times, gone like the wind. On the wild card line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hey, Art.
Yes.
This is Kathy again from Palm Desert. How you doing?
I'm fine, Kathy.
Great. Took me about 3 hours again to get through to you tonight.
Well, I'm glad you made it.
Great. Listen, you caught my attention about, what was it, about 40 minutes ago when you were talking to the trucker about some story about putting down a hole?
Oh, the microphone down the hole.
Yeah. What do you know about that?
Well, it's somewhere between myth and truth. Maybe there's a germ of truth in it. The Associated Press did run the story.
Uh-huh.
And because I was doing talk radio the night it ran on AP.
Oh,
so
okay.
I heard it. They claim they lowered this microphone down the ground, the deepest hole ever drilled, and they heard all this screaming and yelping and human agony and misery and thousands of voices in agony, and that's what I know.
Wow. Well, you don't know where the hole was, where the place was?
It was somewhere in Scandinavia, some Scandinavian, it was Denmark or it was Sweden or somewhere in there.
Uh-huh. Pretty interesting, you know.
If you had been the one listening to the headphones and you heard that, Kathy, would it change your life?
Possibly. Very possibly. But I don't know. I mean, kind of...
Listen, Kath, we're out of time. Show's over. I got to go and all that. Tell America good night.
Good night, America.
Good night, America. Thank you. Tomorrow night, same time, same station. Good night.